This is Audible.
Macmillan Audio presents Cress by Marissa Meyer. Read for you by Rebecca Soler. Book 1. When she was just a child, the witch locked her away in a tower that had neither doors nor stairs. Chapter 1. Her satellite made one full orbit around planet Earth every 16 hours. It was a prison that came with an endlessly breathtaking view, vast blue oceans and swirling clouds and sunrises that set half the world on fire. When she was first imprisoned, she had loved nothing more than to stack her pillows on top of the desk that was built into the walls and drape her bed linens over the screens, making a small alcove for herself. She would pretend that she was not on a satellite at all, but in a pod ship en route to the blue planet. Soon, she would land and step out onto real dirt, feel real sunshine, smell real oxygen. She would stare at the continents for hours and hours, imagining what that must be like. Her view of Luna, however, was always to be avoided. Some days, her satellite passed so close that the moon took up the entire view, and she could make out the enormous glinting domes on its surface and the sparkling cities where the lunars lived. Where she, too, had lived. Years ago. Before she'd been banished. As a child, Cress had hidden from the moon during those achingly long hours. Sometimes, she would escape to the small washroom and distract herself by twisting elaborate braids into her hair. Or, she would scramble beneath her desk and sing lullabies until she fell asleep. Or she would dream up a mother and a father and imagine how they would play make-believe with her and read her adventure stories and brush her hair lovingly off her brow. Until finally, the moon would sink again behind the protective Earth, and she was safe. Even now, Cress used those hours to crawl beneath her bed and nap or read or write songs in her head or work out complicated coding. She still did not like to look at the cities of Luna. She harbored a secret paranoia that if she could see the lunars, surely they could look up beyond their artificial skies and see her. For more than 7 years, this had been her nightmare. But now, the silver horizon of Luna was creeping into the corner of her window, and Cress paid no attention. This time, her wall of invisiscreens was showing her a brand new nightmare. Brutal words were splattered across the news feeds, photos and videos blurring in her vision as she scrolled from one feed to the next. She couldn't read fast enough. 14 cities attacked worldwide. 2-hour murder spree results in 16,000 earthen deaths. Largest massacre in third era. The net was littered with horrors. Victims dead in the streets with shredded abdomens and blood leaking into the gutters. Feral men creatures with gore on their chins and beneath their fingernails and staining the front of their shirts. She scrolled through them all with one hand pressed over her mouth. Breathing became increasingly difficult as the truth of it all sank in. This was her fault. For months she had been cloaking those lunar ships from earthen detection, doing Mistress Sybil's bidding without question, like the well-trained lackey she was. Now, she knew just what kind of monsters had been aboard those ships. Only now did she understand what Her Majesty had been planning all along, and it was far too late. 16,000 earthen deaths. Earth had been taken unaware, and all because she hadn't been brave enough to say no to Mistress's demands. She had done her job and then turned a blind eye to it all. She averted her gaze from the pictures of death and carnage, focusing on another news story that suggested more horrors to come. Emperor Cato of the Eastern Commonwealth had put an end to the attacks by agreeing to marry Lunar Queen Levana. Queen Levana was to become the Commonwealth's new empress. The shocked journalists of Earth were scrambling to determine their stance on this diplomatic yet controversial arrangement. Some were in outrage, proclaiming that the Commonwealth and the rest of the Earthen Union should be preparing for war, not a wedding. But others were hastily trying to justify the alliance. With a swirl of her fingers on the thin, transparent screen, Cress raised the audio of a man who was going on about the potential benefits. No more attacks or speculations on when an attack might come. Earth would come to understand the lunar culture better. They would share technological advances. They would be allies. And besides, Queen Levana only wanted to rule the Eastern Commonwealth. Surely she would leave the rest of the Earthen Union alone. But Cress knew they would be fools to believe it. Queen Levana was going to become empress. Then she would have Emperor Kato murdered, claim the country for her own, and use it as a launching pad to assemble her army before invading the rest of the Union. She would not stop until the entire planet was under her control. This small attack, these 16,000 deaths, they were only the beginning. Silencing the broadcast, Cress set her elbows on her desk and dug both hands into her hive of blonde hair. She was suddenly cold, despite the consistently maintained temperature inside the satellite. One of the screens behind her was reading aloud in a child's voice that had been programmed during 4 months of insanity-inducing boredom when she was 10 years old. The voice was too chipper for the material it quoted. A medical blog from the American Republic announcing the results of an autopsy performed on one of the lunar soldiers.
The bones had been reinforced with calcium-rich biotissue, while the cartilage in major joints was infused with a saline solution for added flexibility and pliability. Orthodontic implants replaced the canine and incisor teeth with those mimicking the teeth of a wolf. And we see the same bone reinforcement around the jaw, to allow for the strength to crush material such as bone and other tissue. Remapping of the central nervous system and extensive psychological tampering were responsible for the subject's unyielding aggression and wolf-like tendencies. Dr. Edelstein has theorized that an advanced manipulation technique of the brain's bioelectric waves may also have played a role in
mute feed. The sweet 10-year-old's voice was silenced, leaving the satellite humming with the sounds that had long ago been relegated to the back of Cress's consciousness. The whirring of fans, the thrumming of the life support system, the gurgling of the water recycling tank. Cress gathered the thick locks of hair at the nape of her neck and pulled the tail over her shoulder. It had a tendency to get caught up in the wheels of her chair when she wasn't careful. The screens before her flickered and scrolled as more and more information came in from the Earthen feeds. News was coming out from Luna, too, on their brave soldiers and hard-fought victory. Crown-sanctioned drivel, naturally. Cress had stopped paying attention to lunar news when she was 12. She mindlessly wrapped her ponytail around her left arm, spiraling it from elbow to wrist, unaware of the tangles clumping in her lap.
"Oh, Cress," she murmured. "What are we going to do?"
Her 10-year-old self piped back.
"Please clarify your instructions, big sister."
Cress shut her eyes against the screen's glare.
"I understand that Emperor Kai is only trying to stop a war, but he must know this won't stop Her Majesty. She's going to kill him if he goes through with this. And then where will Earth be?"
A headache pounded at her temples.
"I thought for certain Lynsinder had told him at the ball, but what if I'm wrong? What if he still has no idea of the danger he's in?"
Spinning in her chair, she swiped her fingers across a muted newsfeed, punched in a code, and called up the hidden window that she checked 100 times a day. The DCOM window opened like a black hole,
abandoned and silent, on top of her desk. Lynn Cinder still had not tried to contact her. Perhaps her chip had been confiscated or destroyed. Perhaps Lynn Cinder didn't even have it anymore. Puffing, Cress dismissed the link and, with a few hasty taps of her fingertips, cascaded a dozen different windows in its place. They were linked to a spider alert service that was constantly patrolling the net for any information related to the lunar cyborg who had been taken into custody a week earlier. Lynn Cinder, the girl who had escaped from New Beijing prison. The girl who had been Cress's only chance of telling Emperor Kato the truth about Queen Lavanna's intentions should he agree to the marriage alliance. The major feed hadn't been updated in 11 hours. In the hysteria of the lunar invasion, Earth seemed to have forgotten about their most wanted fugitive.
Big sister?
Pulse hiccuping, Cress grasped the arms of her chair.
Yes, little Cress?
Mistress's ship detected. Expected arrival in 22 seconds.
Cress catapulted from her chair at the word mistress, spoken even all those years ago with a tinge of dread. Her movements were a precisely choreographed dance, one she had mastered after years of practice. In her mind, she became a second-era ballerina, skimming across a shadowy stage as little Cress counted down the seconds. 0021. Cress pressed her palm onto the mattress deploy button. 0020. She swiveled back to the screen, sending all feeds of Lynn Cinder beneath a layer of Lunar Crown propaganda. 0019. The mattress landed with a thunk on the floor, the pillows and blankets wadded up just as she'd left them. 0018. 17. 16. Her fingers danced across the screens, hiding earthen news feeds and net groups. 0015. A turn, a quick search for two corners of her blanket. 0014. A flick of her wrists, casting the blanket up like a wind-caught sail. 0013. 12. 11. She smoothed and tugged her way to the opposite side of the bed, pivoting toward the screens on the other side of her living quarters. 0010. 9. Earthen dramas, music recordings, second-era literature, all dismissed. 008. A swivel back toward the bed, a graceful turning down of the blanket. 007. Two pillows symmetrically stacked against the headboard, a flourish of her arm to pull out the hair that had gotten caught beneath the blanket. 006. A glissade across the floor, dipping and spinning, gathering up every discarded sock and hair tie, and sending them into the renewal chute. 004. 3. A sweep of the desks, collecting her only bowl, her only spoon, her only glass, and a handful of stylus pens, and depositing them into the pantry cabinet. 002. A final pirouette to scan her work. 001. A pleased exhalation, culminating in a graceful bow.
Mistress has arrived, said little Cress. She is requesting an extension of the docking clamp.
The stage, the shadows, the music, all fell away from Cress's thoughts, though a practiced smile remained on her lips.
Of course, she chirped,
swanning toward the main boarding ramp. There were two ramps on her satellite, but only one had ever been used. She wasn't even sure if the opposite entrance functioned. Each wide metal door opened up to a docking hatch, and, beyond that, space. Except for when there was a pod ship anchored there. Mistress's pod ship. Cress tapped in the command. A diagram on the screen showed the clamp extending, and she heard the thump as the ship attached. The walls jolted around her. She had the next moments memorized, could have counted the heartbeats between each familiar sound. The whir of the small spacecraft's engines powering down, the clang of the hatch attaching and sealing around the pod ship, the vacuum as oxygen was pushed into the space, the beep confirming that travel between the two modules was safe. the opening of the spacecraft, steps echoing on the walkway, the whoosh of the satellite entrance. There had been a time when Cress had hoped for warmth and kindness from her mistress, that perhaps Sybil would look at her and say, "My dear sweet Crescent, you have earned the trust and respect of Her Majesty the Queen. You are welcome to return with me to Luna and be accepted as one of us." That time had long since passed, but Cress's practiced smile held firm, even in the face of Mistress Sybil's coldness.
"Good day, Mistress."
Sybil sniffed. The embroidered sleeves of her white jacket fluttered around the large case she carried, filled with her usual provisions, food and fresh water for Cress's confinement and, of course, the medical kit.
"So you've found her, have you?"
Cress winced around her frozen grin.
"Found her, Mistress?"
"If it is a good day, then you must have finally completed the simple task I've given you. Is that it, Crescent? Have you found the cyborg?"
Cress lowered her gaze and dug her fingernails into her palms.
"No, Mistress, I haven't found her."
"I see. So it isn't a good day after all, is it?"
"I only meant, your company is always..."
She trailed off, forcing her hands to unclench. She dared to meet Mistress Sybil's glare.
"I was just reading the news, Mistress. I thought perhaps we were pleased about Her Majesty's engagement."
Sybil dropped the case onto the crisply made bed.
"We will be satisfied once Earth is under lunar control. Until then, there is work to be done, and you should not be wasting your time reading news and gossip."
Sybil neared the monitor that held the secret window with the DCOM feed and the evidence of Cress's betrayal to the Lunar Crown, and Cress stiffened. But Sybil reached past it to a screen displaying a vid of Emperor Kato speaking in front of the Eastern Commonwealth flag. With a touch, the screen cleared, revealing the metal wall and a tangle of heating tubes behind it. Cress slowly released her breath.
"I certainly hope you've found something."
She stood taller.
"Lynsinder was spotted in the European Federation, in a small town in southern France, at approximately 1800 local to—"
"I'm well aware of all that. And then she went to Paris and killed a thaumaturge and some useless special operatives. Anything else, Crescent?"
Cress swallowed and began winding her hair around both wrists in a looping figure eight.
"At 1748 in Rio, France, the clerk of a ship and vehicle parts store updated the store inventory, removing one power cell that would be compatible with a 214 Rampion Class 11.3, but not notating any sort of payment. I thought perhaps Lynsinder stole, or maybe glamored."
She hesitated. Sybil liked to keep up the pretense that the cyborg was a shell, even though they both knew it wasn't true.
Unlike Cress, who was a true shell, Lynsinder had the lunar gift. It may have been buried or hidden somehow, but it had certainly made itself known at the Commonwealth's annual ball. "A power cell?" Sybil said, passing over Cress's hesitation.
"It converts compressed hydrogen into energy in order to propel—"
"I know what it is," Sybil snapped. "You're telling me that the only progress you've made is finding evidence that she's making repairs to her ship? That it's going to become even more difficult to track her down, a task that you couldn't even manage when they were on Earth?"
"I'm sorry, Mistress. I'm trying, it's just—"
"I'm not interested in your excuses. All these years, I've persuaded Her Majesty to let you live, under the premise that you had something valuable to offer, something even more valuable than blood. Was I wrong to protect you, Crescent?"
She bit her lip, withholding a reminder of all she'd done for Her Majesty during her imprisonment. Designing countless spy systems for keeping watch on Earth's leaders, hacking the communication links between diplomats, and jamming satellite signals to allow the Queen's soldiers to invade Earth undetected, so that now the blood of 16,000 Earthens was on her hands. It made no difference. Sybil cared only about Kress's failures, and not finding Lynn Cinder was Kress's biggest failure to date.
I'm sorry, mistress. I'll try harder.
Sybil's eyes narrowed. I'll be very displeased if you don't find me that girl, and soon.
Held by Sybil's gaze, she felt like a moth pinned to an examination board.
Yes, mistress.
Good.
Reaching forward, Sybil petted her cheek. It felt almost like a mother's approval, but not quite. Then, she turned away and released the locking mechanisms on the case.
Now then, she said, retrieving a hypodermic needle from the medical kit. Your arm.
Chapter 2 Wolf pushed himself off the crate, hurtling toward her. Cinder braced herself against the instinctive panic. The anticipation of one more hit tightened every muscle, despite the fact that he was still going easy on her. She squeezed her eyes shut moments before impact and focused. Pain shot through her head like a chisel into her brain. She gritted her teeth against it, attempting to numb herself to the waves of nausea that followed. The impact didn't come.
Stop closing your eyes.
Jaws still clenched, she forced one eye open, and then the other. Wolf stood before her, his right hand in mid-swing toward her ear. His body was still a stone, because she was holding him there. His energy was hot and palpable and just out of reach, the strength of her own lunar gift keeping him at bay.
It's easier to have them closed, she hissed back.
Even those few words put a strain on her mind, and Wolf's fingers twitched. He was struggling against the confines of her control. Then his gaze flickered past her, as a thump between her shoulder blades sent Cinder tumbling forward. Her forehead collided with Wolf's chest, his body released just in time for him to steady her. Behind her, Thorn chuckled.
It also makes it easier for people to sneak up on you.
Cinder spun around and shoved Thorn away. This isn't a game.
Thorn is right, said Wolf. She could hear his exhaustion, though she wasn't sure whether it came from the constant melee or, more likely, his frustration at having to train such an amateur.
When you close your eyes, it makes you vulnerable. You have to learn to use the gift while still being aware of your surroundings, while still being active within them.
Active?
Wolf stretched his neck to either side, eliciting a few pops before shaking it out.
Yes, active.
We could be facing dozens of soldiers at a time. With any luck, you'll be able to control 9 or 10,
although that's optimistic at this point.
She crinkled her nose at him.
Which means you'll be vulnerable to countless more. You should be able to control me while still being fully present, both mentally and physically.
He took a step back, pawing at his messy hair. If even Thorn can sneak up on you, we're in trouble.
Thorn cuffed his sleeves.
Never underestimate the stealth of a criminal mastermind.
Scarlet started laughing from where she sat cross-legged on a plastic storage crate, enjoying a bowl of oatmeal.
Criminal mastermind? We've been trying to figure out how to infiltrate the royal wedding for the past week, and so far, your biggest contribution has been determining which of the palace's rooftops is the most spacious so your precious ship doesn't get scratched in the landing.
A few light panels brightened along the ceiling.
I fully agree with Captain Thorne's priorities, said Iko, speaking through the ship's built-in speakers. As this may be my big net debut, I'd like to be looking my best, thank you very much.
Well said, gorgeous, Thorne winked up toward the speakers, even though Iko's sensors weren't sensitive enough to pick up on it. And I would like the rest of you to note Iko's proper use of captain when addressing me. You could all stand to learn a thing or two from her.
Scarlet laughed again. Wolf raised an eyebrow, unimpressed, and the cargo bay's temperature clicked up a couple of degrees as Iko blushed from the flattery. But Cinder ignored them all, downing a glass of lukewarm water while Wolf's admonishments spun through her head. She knew he was right. Though controlling Wolf strained every ability she had, controlling Earthens like Thorn and Scarlet usually came as easy to her as replacing a dead android sensor. By now, she should have been able to do both.
"Let's go again," she said, tightening her ponytail.
Wolf slipped his attention back to her.
"Maybe you should take a break."
"I won't get a break when I'm being chased down by the Queen's soldiers, will I?" She rolled her shoulders, trying to re-energize herself. The pain in her head had dulled, but the back of her t-shirt was damp with sweat, and every muscle was trembling from the effort of sparring with Wolf for the past 2 hours. Wolf rubbed his temple.
"Let's hope you never have to face off against the Queen's real soldiers. I think we stand a chance going up against her thaumaturges and special operatives, but the advanced soldiers are different, more like animals than humans, and they don't react well to brain manipulation."
"Because so many people do," said Scarlet, scraping her spoon against the bowl.
His glance flickered toward her, something in his eyes softening. It was a look Cinder had seen 100 times since he and Scarlet had joined the crew of the Rampian, and yet, seeing it still made her feel like she was intruding on something intimate.
"I mean, they're unpredictable, even under the control of a thaumaturge."
He returned his focus to Cinder.
"Or any other lunar. The genetic tampering they undergo to become soldiers affects their brains as much as their bodies. They're sporadic, wild, dangerous."
Thorn leaned against Scarlet's storage crate, fake whispering to her.
"He does realize that he's an ex-Street Fighter who still goes by Wolf, right?"
Cinder bit the inside of her cheek, smothering a laugh.
"All the more reason for me to be as prepared as possible. I'd like to avoid another close call like we had in Paris."
"You're not the only one."
Wolf started to sway on the balls of his feet again. Cinder had once thought this indicated that he was ready for another sparring match, but she'd lately begun to think that's just how he was, always moving, always restless.
"Which reminds me," she said, "I'd like to get some more of those tranquilizer darts whenever we land again. The fewer soldiers we have to fight or brainwash, the better."
"Tranquilizer darts, got it," said Iko. "I've also taken the liberty of programming this handy countdown clock. T-minus 15 days, 9 hours until the royal wedding."
The net screen on the wall flickered to life, displaying an enormous digital clock counting down by the 1/10 of a second. 3 seconds of staring at that clock made Cinder sick with anxiety. She tore her gaze away, scanning the rest of the net screen and their ongoing master plan for putting a stop to the wedding between Kai and Queen Lavanna. A list of needed supplies was jotted down on the left of the screen. Weapons, tools, disguises, and now, tranquilizer darts. In the middle of the screen was a blueprint of New Beijing Palace. On the right, a ridiculously long preparation checklist, none of which had yet to be checked off, though they'd been planning and plotting for days. Number one on the list was to prepare Cinder for when she would inevitably come face to face with Queen Lavanna and her court again. Though Wolf hadn't said it outright, she knew her lunar gift wasn't improving fast enough. Cinder was beginning to think that item could take years to reach satisfactory completion, and they had only 2 more weeks. The rough plan was to cause a distraction on the day of the wedding that would allow them to sneak into the palace during the ceremony and announce to the world that Cinder was truly the lost Princess Selene. Then, with all the world's media watching, Cinder would demand that Lavanna relinquish the crown to her, ending both the wedding and her rule in one fell swoop. Everything that was supposed to follow the wedding blurred in Cinder's mind. She kept imagining the reactions of the lunar people when they discovered that their lost princess was not only cyborg, but also
entirely ignorant of their world, culture, traditions, and politics. The only thing that kept her chest from being crushed by the weight of it all was the knowledge that, no matter what, she couldn't possibly be any worse of a ruler than Lavanna. She hoped they would see it that way, too. The glass of water sloshed in her stomach. For the thousandth time, a fantasy crept into her thoughts of crawling beneath the covers of her crew-issued bunk bed and hiding until all the world forgot there had ever been a lunar princess in the first place. Instead, she turned away from the screen and shook out her muscles.
"All right, I'm ready to try again," she said, settling into the fighting stance that Wolf had taught her.
But Wolf was now sitting beside Scarlet and polishing off her oatmeal. Mouth full, he dipped his eyes to the floor and swallowed.
"Push-ups."
Cinder dropped her arms.
"What?"
He gestured at her with the spoon.
"Fighting isn't the only type of physical exertion. We can build your upper body strength and train your mind at the same time. Just try to stay aware of your surroundings. Focus."
She glowered for 5 full seconds before dropping to the ground. She'd counted to 11 when she heard Thorn push himself away from the crate.
"You know, when I was a kid, I was tricked into thinking that princesses wore tiaras and hosted tea parties. Now that I've met a real princess, I must say, I'm kind of disappointed."
She didn't know if he meant it as an insult, but these days, the word princess set every one of Cinder's nerves on edge. Exhaling sharply, she did just as Wolf had instructed. She focused, easily picking up on Thorn's energy as he passed by her on his way toward the cockpit. She was lowering into the 14th push-up when she forced his feet to stall beneath him.
"What?"
Cinder pushed up and swung one leg forward in a half circle. Her ankle collided with the back of Thorn's calves. He cried out and fell, landing on his backside with a grunt. Beaming, Cinder glanced up at Wolf for approval, but both he and Scarlet were too busy laughing. She could even see the sharp points of Wolf's canine teeth that he was usually so careful to keep hidden. Cinder stood and offered Thorn a hand. Even he was smiling, though it was coupled with a grimace as he rubbed his hip.
"You can help me pick out a tiara when we're done saving the world."
Chapter 3. The satellite shuddered as Sybil's podship disconnected from the docking clamp, and Kress was left alone again in the galaxy. Despite how Kress yearned for companionship, it was always a relief when Sybil left her, and this time, even more than usual. Normally, her mistress only visited every 3 or 4 weeks, just often enough to safely take another blood sample. But this was the third time she'd come since the wolf hybrid attacks. Kress couldn't remember her mistress ever seeming so anxious. Queen Lavanna must have been growing desperate to find the cyborg girl.
"Mistress's ship has detached," said little Kress. "Shall we play a game?"
If Kress hadn't been so flustered from yet another visit, she would have smiled, as she usually did when little Kress asked this question. It was a reminder that she wasn't entirely without companionship. Kress had learned years ago that the word satellite came from a Latin word meaning a companion, or a minion, or a sycophant. All three interpretations had struck her as ironic, given her solitude, until she programmed little Kress. Then she understood. Her satellite kept her company. Her satellite did her bidding. Her satellite never questioned her, or disagreed, or had any pesky thoughts of her own.
"Maybe we can play a game later," she said. "We'd better check the files first." "Certainly, big sister."
It was the expected response, the programmed response. Kress often wondered if that's what it would be like to be truly lunar, to have that sort of control over another human being. She would fantasize about programming Mistress Sybil as easily as she'd programmed her satellite's voice. How the game would change then, if her mistress was to follow her orders for once, rather than the other way around. All screens on. Kress stood before her panorama of Invisiscreens, some large, others small, some set on top of the built-in desk, others bracketed to the satellite walls and angled for optimal viewing no matter where she was in the circular room. Clear all feeds. The screens went blank, allowing her to see through them to the satellite's unadorned walls. Display compiled folders, Lynn Cinder, 214 Rampian, Class 11.3, Emperor Cato of the Eastern Commonwealth, and, she paused, enjoying the rush of anticipation that passed through her, Carswell Thorne. Four screens filled up with the information Kress had been collecting. She sat down to review the documents she'd all but memorized. On the morning of 29 August, Lynn Cinder and Carswell Thorne escaped from New Beijing prison. 4 hours later, Sybil had given Kress her orders. Find them. The command, Kress later discovered, came from Queen Levana herself. Scrounging up information on Lynn Cinder had taken her only 3 minutes. But then, almost all the information she'd found was fake. A fake Earthen identity written up for a girl who was lunar. Kress didn't even know how long Lynn Cinder had been on Earth. She'd simply popped into existence 5 years ago, when she was, supposedly, 11 years old. Her biography had family and school records prior to the hover accident that had killed her parents and resulted in her cyborg operation. But that was all false. One had to follow Lynn Cinder's ancestry back only 2 generations before they hit a dead end. The records had been written to deceive. Kress glanced at the folder still downloading information on Emperor Cato. His file was immeasurably longer than the others, as every moment of his life had been recorded and filed away, from net fan groups to official government documentation. Information was being added all the time, and it had exploded since the announcement of his engagement to the Lunar Queen. None of it was helpful. Kress closed the feed. Carswell Thorne's folder had required a bit more legwork. It took Kress 44 minutes to hack into the government records of the American Republic's military database and 5 other agencies that had dealings with him, compiling trial transcripts and articles, military records and education reports, licenses and income statements, and a timeline that began with his certificate of birth and continued through numerous accolades and awards won while he was growing up, through his acceptance into the American Republic military at age 17. The timeline blinked out after his 19th birthday, when he removed his identity chip, stole a spaceship, and deserted the military. The day he'd gone rogue. It started up again 18 months later, on the day he was found and arrested in the Eastern Commonwealth. In addition to all the official reports, there was a fair amount of swooning and gossiping from the many fan groups that had sprouted in the wake of Carswell Thorne's new celebrity status. Not nearly as many as Emperor Kai had, of course, but it seemed that plenty of Earthen girls were taken with the idea of this handsome rake on the run from the law. Kress wasn't bothered by it. She knew that they all had the wrong idea about him. At the top of his file was a 3-dimensional holograph scanned in from his military graduation. Kress preferred it to the infamous prison photo that had become so popular, the one in which he was winking at the camera. Because in the holograph, he was wearing a freshly pressed uniform with shining silver buttons and a confident, one-sided grin. Seeing that smile, Kress melted. Every time. "Hello again, Mr. Thorne," she whispered to the holograph. Then, with a giddy sigh, she turned to the only remaining folder. The 214 Rampian Class 11.3, the military cargo ship Thorne had stolen. Kress knew everything about the ship, from its floor plan to its maintenance schedule,
both the ideal and the actual. Everything. Including its location. Tapping an icon in the folder's top bar, she replaced Carswell Thorne's holograph with one of a galactic positioning grid. Earth shimmered into existence, the jagged edges of its continents as familiar to her as Little Cress's programming. After all, she had spent half her life watching the planet from 26,071 kilometers away. Encircling the planet flickered thousands of tiny dots that indicated every ship and satellite from here to Mars. A glance told Cress that she could look out her Earthside window right then and spot an unsuspecting Commonwealth scouting ship passing by her nondescript satellite. There was a time when she would have been tempted to hail them. But what would be the point? No Earthen would ever trust a lunar, much less rescue one. So, Cress ignored the ship, humming to herself as she cleared away all the tiny markers on the holograph until only the Rampian's ID remained. A single yellow dot, disproportionate in the holograph, so that she could analyze it in the context of the planet below. It hovered 12,414 kilometers above the Atlantic Ocean. She called up the ID of her own orbiting satellite. If one were to attach a string from her satellite to the center of the Earth, it would cut right through the coast of Japan province. Nowhere near each other. They never were. It was a huge orbiting field, after all. Finding the coordinates of the Rampian had been one of the greatest challenges of Cress's hacking career. Even then, it had taken her only 3 hours and 51 minutes to do it, and all the while her pulse and adrenaline had been singing. She had to find them first. She had to find them first. Because she had to protect them. In the end, it had been a question of mathematics and deduction, using the satellite network to ping signals off of the ships orbiting Earth. Discarding those with trackers, as she knew that the Rampian had been stripped. Discarding those that were clearly too big or too small. That left mostly lunar ships, and all of those were, of course, already under her dominion. She'd been disrupting their signals and confusing radar waves for years. There were many Earthens who believed lunar ships were invisible because of a lunar mind trick. If only they'd known that it was actually a worthless shell causing them so much trouble. In the end, only 3 ships were orbiting Earth that fit the criteria, and 2 of them, no doubt illegal pirating ships, wasted no time in landing on Earth once they realized there was a massive space search going on that they were about to be caught in the middle of. Cress, out of curiosity, had later scanned Earthen police records in their proximity and found that both ships had been discovered upon re-entering Earth's atmosphere. Silly criminals. That left only one. The Rampian. And aboard it, Lynn Cinder and Carswell Thorne. Within 12 minutes of pinpointing their location, Cress scrambled every signal that posed any risk of finding them, using the same method. Like magic, the 214 Rampian, class 11.3, had vanished into space. Then, nerves frazzled from the mental strain, she'd collapsed onto her unmade bed and beamed deliriously at the ceiling. She'd done it. She had made them invisible. A chirp resounded from one of the screens, pulling Cress's attention away from the floating dot that represented the Rampian. Cress spun toward it, flinching when a strand of hair caught in the chair's wheels. She yanked it out with one hand and nudged the screen out of hibernation with the other. A flick of her fingers and the window was enlarged. Conspiracy theories of the Third Era. "Not another one," she muttered. The conspiracy theorists had been slobbering over themselves ever since the cyborg girl had disappeared. Some said that Lynn Cinder was working for the Commonwealth's government, or Queen Levana,
or that she was in cahoots with a secret society determined to overthrow one government or another, or that she was the missing lunar princess, or that she knew where the lunar princess was, or that she was somehow tied to the spread of Letimosis, or that she had seduced Emperor Kato and was now pregnant with a lunar earthen cyborg thing. There were almost as many rumors surrounding Carswell Thorne. They included theories on the real reason that he was in prison, such as plotting to kill the last emperor, or how he'd been working with Lynn Cinder for years prior to her arrest, or how he was connected to an underground network that had infiltrated the prison system years ago in preparation for the day when he would require their assistance. This newest theory was suggesting that Carswell Thorne was, in fact, an undercover lunar thaumaturge meant to assist Lynn Cinder with her escape so that Luna would have an excuse for starting the war. Essentially, nobody knew anything. Except for Kress, who knew the truth of Carswell Thorne's crimes, his trial, and his escape. At least, the elements of the escape she'd been able to piece together using prison surveillance video and the statements from the on-duty guards. In fact, Kress was convinced that she knew more about Carswell Thorne than anyone else alive. In a life in which newness and novelty were so rare, he had become a fixture of fascination to her. At first, she was disgusted by him and his apparent greed and recklessness. When he'd deserted the military, he'd left half a dozen cadets and two commanding officers stranded on an island in the Caribbean. He had stolen a collection of second-era goddess sculptures from a private collector in the Eastern Commonwealth, and a set of Venezuelan dream dolls on loan to a museum in Australia to potentially never be seen in public again. There were additional claims of an unsuccessful robbery of a young widow from the Commonwealth who owned an extensive collection of antique jewelry. Kress had continued to dig, entranced by his path of self-destruction. Like watching an asteroid collision, she couldn't look away. But then, strange anomalies had begun to creep up in her research. Age 8. The city of Los Angeles spent 4 days in panic after a rare Sumatran tiger escaped from a zoo. Video surveillance of the cage showed the young Carswell Thorne, there on a field trip with his class, opening the cage. He later told the authorities that the tiger had looked sad locked up like that, and that he didn't regret it. Luckily, no one, including the tiger, had been hurt. Age 11. A police report was filed by his parents claiming they'd been robbed. Overnight, a second-era diamond necklace had gone missing from his mother's jewelry chest. The necklace was traced to a net sales listing, where it had recently sold for 40,000 univs to a buyer in Brazil. The seller was, of course, Carswell himself, who had not yet had a chance to send off the necklace and was forced to return the payment, along with an official apology. That apology, made public record to prevent other teams from getting the same idea, claimed that he was only trying to raise money for a local charity offering android assistance to the elderly. Age 13. Carswell Thorne was given a week-long school suspension after fighting with 3 boys in his grade, a fight he had lost according to the school's Medroid report. His statement proclaimed that one of the boys had stolen a port screen from a girl named Kate Fallow. Carswell had been trying to get it back. One situation after another was brought to Kress's attention. Theft, violence, trespassing, school suspensions, police reprimands. Yet Carswell Thorne, when given a chance to explain, always had a reason. A good reason. A heart-stopping, pulse-racing, awe-inspiring reason. Like the sun rising over Earth's horizon, her perception began to change. Carswell Thorne wasn't a heartless scoundrel at all. If anyone bothered to get to know him, they would see that he was compassionate and chivalrous. He was exactly the kind of hero Kress had been dreaming about her entire life. With that discovery, thoughts of Carswell Thorne began to infiltrate her every waking moment. She dreamed of deep soul connections and passionate kisses and daring escapes. She was certain that he simply had to meet her, just once, and he would feel the same way. It would be like those epic love affairs that exploded into existence and burned white hot for all eternity. The type of love that time and distance and even death couldn't separate. Because if there was one thing Kress knew about heroes, it was that they could not resist a damsel in distress. And she was nothing if not in distress. Chapter 4. Scarlet pressed a cotton pad to the corner of Wolf's mouth, shaking her head.
She may not get in many hits, but when she does, she makes them count.
Despite the bruise creeping around his jaw, Wolf was beaming, his eyes bright beneath the medbay's lights.
Did you see how she tripped up my feet before she swung? I didn't see it coming.
He rubbed his hands giddily on his thighs, his feet kicking at the side of the exam table.
I think we might finally be getting somewhere.
Well, I'm glad you're proud of her, but I think it would be nice if next time she hit you with her non-metal hand.
Scarlet pulled the cotton away. The wound was still bleeding where Wolf's lip had broken on his upper canine, but not as bad as before. She reached for a tube of healing salve.
You might be adding a new scar to your collection, but it kind of matches the one on this side of your mouth, so at least they're symmetrical.
I don't mind the scars,
he shrugged, his eyes taking on a mischievous spark.
They hold better memories now than they used to.
Scarlet paused with a dab of ointment on her fingertip. Wolf's attention had affixed itself to his own knotted hands, a hint of color on his cheeks. Within seconds, she was feeling extra warm herself, remembering the night they'd once spent as stowaways aboard a maglev train. How she'd traced her fingers along the pale scar on his arm, brushed her lips against the faint marks on his face, then taken into his arms. She shoved him on the shoulder.
Stop smiling so much, she said, dabbing the salve onto the wound. You're making it worse.
He quickly schooled his features, but the glint remained in his eyes when he dared to look up at her. That night on the maglev remained the only time they'd kissed. Scarlet couldn't count the time he'd kissed her while she was being held captive by him and the rest of his special operative pack. He had used the chance to give her an ID chip that ultimately helped her escape. But there had been no affection in that kiss. And at the time, she'd despised him. But those moments aboard the maglev had caused more than one sleepless night since coming aboard the Rampian. When she had lain awake and imagined slipping out of her bed, creeping across the corridor to Wolf's room, not saying a word when he opened the door, just pulling herself against him, curling her hands into his hair, wrapping herself up in the sort of security that she'd only ever found in his arms. She never did, though. Not for fear of rejection. Wolf hadn't exactly tried to conceal his lingering gazes, or how he leaned into every touch, no matter how trivial. And he had never taken back what he had said after the attack.
You're the only one, Scarlet. You'll always be the only one.
Scarlet knew he was waiting for her to make the first move. But every time she found herself tempted, she would see the tattoo on his arm, the one that marked him forever as a lunar special operative. Her heart was still broken from the loss of her grandmother, and the knowledge that Wolf could have saved her. He could have protected her. He could have prevented it all from happening in the first place.
Which wasn't fair to him.
That was before he'd known Scarlet, before he'd cared. and if he had tried to rescue her grandmother, the other operatives would have killed him, too. Then Scarlett really would be alone. Maybe her hesitation was because, if she were being honest with herself, she was still a little afraid of Wolf. When he was happy and flirtatious and, at times, adorably awkward, it was easy to forget that there was another side to him. But Scarlett had seen him fight too many times to forget. Not like the restrained brawls he and Cinder had, but fights where he could ruthlessly snap a man's neck or tear an opponent's flesh from his bones using nothing but his own sharp teeth. The memories still made her shudder.
Scarlett?
She jumped. Wolf was watching her. His brow creased.
What's wrong?
Nothing. She called up a smile, relieved when it didn't feel strained. Yes, there was something dark inside him, but the monster she'd seen before was not the same as the man seated before her now. Whatever those lunar scientists had done to him, Wolf had shown time and again that he could make his own choices, that he could be different.
I was just thinking about scars, she said, screwing the cap back onto the ointment.
Wolf's lip had stopped bleeding, though the bruise would last a few days. Cupping his chin, Scarlett tilted Wolf's face away from her and pressed a kiss against the wound. He inhaled sharply, but otherwise became as still as rock, an unusual feat for him.
I think you'll survive, she said, pulling away and tossing the bandage into the trash chute.
Scarlett? Wolf?
Iko's voice crackled through the wall speakers.
Can you come out to the cargo bay? There's something on the news feeds you might want to see.
Be right there,
said Scarlett, stashing away the rest of the supplies as Wolf jumped down from the exam table. When she glanced over at him, he was grinning, one finger rubbing against the cut. In the cargo bay, Thorn and Cinder were seated on one of the storage crates, hunkered over a deck of paper cards. Cinder's hair was still a mess from her recent semi-victory over Wolf.
Oh, good, said Thorn, glancing up. Scarlett, tell Cinder she's cheating.
I'm not cheating.
You just played back-to-back doubles. You can't do that.
Cinder crossed her arms.
Thorn, I just downloaded the official rulebook into my brain. I know what I can and can't do.
Aha! He snapped his fingers. See?
You can't just download stuff in the middle of a game of Royals. House rules. You're cheating.
Cinder threw up her hands, sending cards fluttering throughout the cargo bay. Scarlett snatched a 3 out of the air.
I was taught that you can't play back-to-back doubles either, but maybe that was just how my grandma played.
Or maybe Cinder's cheating.
I am not!
Clenching her jaw, Cinder growled.
Iko called us out here for something?
Said Scarlett, dropping the card back onto the deck.
Oui, mademoiselle,
said Iko, adopting the accent that Thorn often imitated when talking to Scarlett, though Iko sounded much more authentic.
There's breaking news coming out on the Lunar Special Operatives.
The net screen on the wall flickered as Iko hid the ticking clock and palace blueprint and replaced them with a series of vids. Reporters and grainy footage of armed military personnel coaxing half a dozen muscular men into a secured hover.
It seems that since the attack, the American Republic has been conducting investigations into the operatives, and a sting operation is going down right now in the 3 Republic cities that were attacked, New York, Mexico City, and Sao Paulo. They've already rounded up 59 operatives and 4 thaumaturges to be held as prisoners of war.
Scarlett stepped closer to the screen, which was showing footage from Manhattan Island. It appeared that this particular pack had been hiding out in an abandoned subway line. The operatives were bound at the hands and ankles, and each one had at least 2 guns trained on him from the surrounding troops. But they all looked as carefree as if they were picking wildflowers in a meadow. One even flashed an amused grin at the camera as he was herded past.
Do you know any of them?
Wolf grunted. Not well. The different packs didn't usually socialize, but I'd see them in the dining hall and sometimes during training.
They don't seem too upset, said Thorne. Evidently, they've never tasted prison food.
Cinder came to stand beside Scarlet.
They won't be there for long. The wedding is in 2 weeks, and then they'll be released and sent back to Luna.
Thorne hooked his thumbs into his belt loops.
In that case, this seems like a pretty big waste of time and resources.
I disagree, said Scarlet. The people can't keep living in fear. The government is trying to show that they're doing something to keep the massacres from happening again. This way, they can feel like they have some sort of control over the situation.
Cinder shook her head.
But what happens when Levana retaliates? The whole point of the marriage alliance was to hold her temper in check.
She won't retaliate, said Wolf. I doubt she'll even care.
Scarlet glanced at the tattoo on his forearm.
After all the work she's gone through to create you? Them?
She wouldn't jeopardize the alliance. Not for the operatives, who were only meant to serve one purpose to begin with. To launch that first attack and remind Earth that lunars can be anyone, anywhere. To make them afraid of us.
He began to shuffle restlessly from foot to foot.
She's done with us now.
I hope you're right, said Aiko. Because now that they've discovered how to track the operatives, everyone expects the rest of the Union to follow suit.
How did they find them? Asked Cinder, adjusting her ponytail. A sigh of air whooshed through the cooling system.
It turns out, lunars have managed to reprogram a bunch of the medroids stationed at plague quarantines all over the world. They've been harvesting ID chips from the deceased and shipping them off to these operatives to be reprogrammed and inserted into their bodies so they could blend in with society. Once the government figured out the connection, they just had to follow the trail of the ID chips, and they were led straight to the PAC's operation bases.
Peony.
Cinder shifted closer to the net screen.
That's why the android wanted her chip. You're telling me it would have ended up inside one of them?
Spoken with true derision for our canine friends, said Thorne.
Cinder massaged her temple.
I'm sorry, Wolf, I don't mean you, she hesitated. Except,
I do, though.
Anyone. She was my little sister. How many people have died from this disease, only to have their identities violated like this?
Again, no offense. It's all right, said Wolf. You loved her. I would feel the same way if someone wanted to erase Scarlet's identity and give it to Levana's army.
Scarlet stiffened, heat rushing into her cheeks. He certainly wasn't insinuating.
Aww, squealed Aiko. Did Wolf just say that he loves Scarlet? That is so cute.
Scarlet cringed.
He did not, that wasn't,
she balled her fists against her sides.
Can we get back to the soldiers that are being rounded up, please?
Is she blushing? She sounds like she's blushing.
She's blushing, Thorne confirmed, shuffling the cards. Actually, Wolf is also looking a little flustered.
Focus, please, said Cinder, and Scarlet could have kissed her. So they were taking ID chips from plague victims. Now what? The lights dimmed as Aiko's giddiness diminished.
Well, it won't be happening anymore. All American androids assigned to the quarantines are being evaluated and reprogrammed as we speak, which will no doubt carry into the rest of the Union.
On the screen, the last operative in Manhattan was being loaded into the armored hover. The door clanged and locked shut behind him.
It does take care of one threat, at least, said Scarlet,
thinking of the pack that had kept her prisoner, that had killed her grandmother.
I hope Europe hunts them down, too. I hope they kill them.
I hope they don't think their job is done after this, said Cinder. Like Wolf said,
The real war hasn't even begun yet. Earth should be on high alert right now, preparing for anything. And we should be making sure we're ready to stop this wedding and put you on the throne, added Scarlet, noting how Cinder flinched at the mention of becoming queen. If we can pull this off, the war may never go any further than it already has.
I have a suggestion, said Aiko, replacing the news story of the lunar operatives with an ongoing report for the upcoming wedding. If we're going to be sneaking into New Beijing Palace while Levana is there, why don't we just assassinate her? Not to be all cold-wired murderer about it, but wouldn't that solve a lot of our problems?
It's not that easy, said Cinder. Remember who we're talking about here. She can brainwash hundreds of people at once.
She can't brainwash me, said Aiko. Or you.
Wolf shook his head.
It would take an army to get close enough. She'll have countless guards and thaumaturges with her, not to mention all the earthens she could use as shields or turn into weapons themselves.
Including Kai, Cinder said. The ship's engine sputtered, causing the walls to quake.
You're right. We can't risk that.
No, but we can tell the world that she's a fraud and a murderer. Cinder planted her hands on her hips. They already know she's a monster. We just need to show them that no one is safe if she becomes Empress.
Chapter 5 Screen 4, said Kress, squinting at the grid of icons. Hijack to D5. Without waiting for the animated gesture to cartwheel to his new space, she shifted her attention to the next game. Screen 5. Claim rubies and daggers, discard crowns. The screen sparkled, but she had already moved on. Screen 6. She paused, chewing on the tips of her hair. 12 rows of numbers filled up the screen, some slots left blank, some tinted with colors and patterns. After her brain twisted around an equation she wasn't sure she could have done a second time, the puzzle lit up before her. The solution as clear as a moonrise over Earth. 3A, insert yellow 4. 7B is black, 16. 9G is black, 20. The grid melted away, replaced with a second-era singer swooning into a microphone, the audience swelling with applause.
Congratulations, big sister, said little Kress. You won!
Kress's victory was short-lived. She rolled onto her side and reassessed the first game. Seeing the move that little Kress had made since her last turn squelched her pride. She'd backed herself into a corner. Screen 1, she murmured, swooping her hair over one shoulder and mindlessly knotting the dampened ends around her fingers. 5 knots later, and her victory on screen 6 was forgotten. Little Kress was going to win this one. She sighed and made the best move she could, but it was immediately followed by Little Kress's king moving to the center of the holographic labyrinth and claiming the golden chalice. A laughing jester appeared, gobbling down the rest of the game board. Kress groaned and pulled her hair off her neck, waiting for whatever task her younger self would randomly select for her.
I won!
Said Little Kress. Once the holograph had disappeared back into the screen, the other games automatically locked themselves.
You now owe me 10 minutes of country western line dancing as guided by the following video, followed by 30 jump squats. Let's begin.
Kress rolled her eyes, wishing she hadn't been quite so perky when she recorded the voice. But she did as she was told, sliding off the bed as a mustached man in a large hat appeared on the screens, thumbs hooked into his belt loops. A couple years ago, upon realizing that her living accommodations offered few opportunities to be active, Kress had gone on a fitness kick. She'd installed all the games with a program that chose from a variety of fitness activities, which she would be required to perform from every time she lost. though she'd often regretted the program, it did help her keep from becoming cemented to her chair. And she kind of enjoyed the dancing and yoga routines, although she was not looking forward to those jump squats. Just as the twang of a guitar announced the start of the dance, a loud chime delayed the inevitable. Thumbs locked into her pretend belt loops, Cress glanced around at the screens.
Little Cress, what?
We have received a direct communication link request from unknown user Mechanic.
Her inside spun as if she'd just done a backflip. Mechanic. With a cry, she half stumbled, half fell toward the smallest screen, hastily tapped in the fitness routine override code, checked the firewall and privacy settings, and saw it. A DCOM request, and the most innocent of questions. Except? Mouth dry, Cress smoothed both palms over her hair.
Yes, except!
The window faded away, replaced with blackness, and then? And then, there he was, Carswell Thorne. He was tilted back in a chair, the heels of his boots propped up in front of the screen. Three people stood close behind him, but all Cress could see were those blue eyes staring back at her, directly back at her, beginning to fill with the same breathless awe she felt, the same wonder. The same enchantment. Though they were separated by two screens and vast amounts of empty space, she could feel the link being forged between them in that look, a bond that couldn't be broken. Their eyes had met for the first time, and by the look of pure amazement on his face, she knew he felt it too. Heat crept up into her cheeks. Her hands began to shake.
Aces,
Carswell Thorne murmured. Dropping his feet to the ground, he leaned forward to inspect her closer.
Is that all hair?
The bond snapped, the fantasy of one perfect true love moment disintegrating around her. Sudden, overwhelming panic clawed up Cress's throat. With a squeak, she ducked out of view of the camera and scrambled beneath the desk. Her back struck the wall with a thud that rattled her teeth. She crouched there, skin burning hot and pulse thundering as she took in the room before her. The room that he was now seeing too, with the rumpled bed covers and the mustached man on all the screens telling her to grab her imaginary partner and swing them around.
Where'd she go?
Thorne's voice came to her through the screen. Honestly, Thorne. A girl. Lynsinder?
Do you ever think before you speak?
What? What did I say?
Is that all hair?
Did you see it? It was like a cross between a magpie nest and a ball of yarn after it's been mauled by a cheetah.
A beat. Then.
A cheetah?
It was the first big cat that came to mind.
Cress hurriedly tried to finger comb the tangles around her ears. Her hair hadn't been cut since she'd been put into the satellite, and now hung past her knees. But Sybil didn't bring sharp objects into the satellite, and Cress had long ago stopped worrying about keeping it neatly braided. After all, who was going to see her?
Oh, to have styled her hair that morning! To have worn the dress that didn't have a hole in the collar.
Had she even brushed her teeth since she'd eaten breakfast? She couldn't remember. And now she was sure that she had bits of spinach from her freeze-dried eggs Florentine stuck between them.
Here, let me speak to her.
Shuffling from the screen.
Hello?
A girl again.
I know you can hear me. I'm sorry my friend is such a wingnut. You can just ignore him.
That's usually what we do,
said the other feminine voice. Cress searched hastily for a mirror, or anything that could pass for one.
We need to talk to you. This is Cinder, the mechanic who fixed the android?
The back of Cress's hand smacked into her clothes hamper. It collided with her wheeled chair, which was launched halfway across the room where it hit the far desk, and sent a half-full cup of water tipping and wobbling. Cress froze, her eyes going wide as the glass teetered toward the memory drive that housed little Cress.
Hello? Is this a good time?
The cup came to rest straight and still once more, not a drop having spilled. Cress slowly exhaled.
This was not how this meeting was supposed to go. This was not the fantasy she'd dreamed up 100 times. What had she said in all those dreams? How had she acted? Who had that person been?
All she could think of was the burning mortification of the country western dancer.
Now face your partner and do-si-do.
And her magpie nest hair, her sweating palms, and her deafening pulse. She squeezed her eyes shut and forced herself to focus, to think. She was not a silly little girl hiding beneath her desk. She was an actress. A gorgeous, poised, talented actress. And she was wearing a sequined dress that sparkled like stars, one that would mesmerize anyone who saw her. She was not one to question her own power to charm those around her, any more than a thaumaturge would question her ability to manipulate a crowd. She was breathtaking. She was still hiding under the desk.
Are you there?
A snort.
Yeah, this is going really well.
Carswell Thorne. Cress flinched, but her breaths were becoming less sporadic as she cocooned herself in the fantasy.
This is a drama set, she whispered, quietly enough that they couldn't hear her. She forced it into her imagination. This was not her bedroom, her sanctuary, her prison. This was a drama set, with cameras and lights and dozens of directors and producers and android assistants milling about. And she was an actress.
Little Cress, pause fitness programming. The screens halted, the room going silent, and Cress crawled out from beneath the desk. Cinder was sitting before the screen now, with Carswell Thorne hovering over her shoulder. Cress glanced at him long enough to catch a smile that was perhaps meant to be apologetic, but only served to make her heart skitter.
Hi, said Lynn Cinder. Sorry to surprise you like that. Do you remember me? We spoke a couple of weeks ago on the day of the coronation, and...
Yes, of course, she stammered.
Her knees started to shake as she surreptitiously dragged her chair back toward her and sat down.
I'm glad you're all right.
She forced herself to focus on Lynn Cinder, not on Carswell Thorne. If she only refrained from meeting his gaze again, she would manage. She would not fall apart. And yet, the temptation to fix her eyes on him was still there, tugging at her.
Thanks, said Linder. I wasn't sure, do you follow Earthen news? Do you know what's been happening since I know everything?
Cinder paused. Cress realized her words had come out all mushed together, and she reminded herself to enunciate when she was playing such a sophisticated role. She forced herself to sit up a bit straighter.
I follow all the news feeds, she clarified. I knew you were spotted in France, and I've been tracking your ship, so I knew it hadn't been destroyed. But I still didn't know whether you'd been injured, or what had happened, and I've been trying to establish the DCOM link, but you never responded.
She deflated a little, her fingers tying knots into her hair.
But I am glad to see that you're all right.
Yes, yes, she's fine, we're fine, everybody's fine, said Thorne,
perching an elbow on Cinder's shoulder and leaning toward the screen with furrowed brows. Meeting his eyes was unavoidable, and an involuntary squeak slipped past her lips, a sound she'd never heard herself make before.
Did you just say you've been tracking our ship?
She opened her mouth, but shut it a moment later when no sound followed. Finally, she managed a brittle nod. Thorne squinted at her as if trying to figure out if she were lying, or merely an idiot. She longed to crawl back beneath the desk.
Really? He drawled. And who do you work for again?
You are an actress.
An actress.
Mistress, she said, forcing the word. Mistress Sybil. She ordered me to find you, but I haven't told her anything, and I won't. You don't have to worry about that. I've been jamming the radar signals, making sure surveillance satellites are faced the other way when you pass, that sort of thing, so no one else could find you.
She hesitated, realizing that four faces were gaping at her, as if all her hair had just fallen out.
You must have noticed that you haven't been caught yet.
Lifting an eyebrow, Cinder slid her gaze over to Thorn, who let out a sudden laugh. All this time we thought Cinder was casting some witchy spell on the other ships. And it's been you? Cinder frowned, but Kress couldn't tell who her annoyance was directed at.
I guess we owe you a huge thanks.
Kress's shoulders jerked into an uncomfortable shrug.
It wasn't that difficult. Finding you was the hardest part, but anyone could have figured it out. And sneaking ships around the galaxy is something Lunars have been doing for years.
I have a price on my head large enough to buy the province of Japan, said Cinder. If anyone could have figured it out, they would have by now. So really, thank you.
A blush crept down her neck.
Thorn jabbed Cinder in the arm. Soften her up with flattery. Good strategy.
Cinder rolled her eyes. Look, the reason we're contacting you is because we need your help.
Evidently, more than I realized.
Yes, Kress said emphatically, unwrapping the hair from her wrists. Yes, whatever you need.
Thorn beamed. See? Why can't you all be this agreeable?
The second girl smacked him on the shoulder. She doesn't even know what we want her to do yet.
Kress really looked at her for the first time. She had curly red hair, a collection of freckles over her nose, and curves that were unfairly exaggerated next to Cinder, who was all angles in comparison. The man beside her dwarfed them both and had brown hair that stuck up in every direction, faded scars that hinted at more than his share of scuffles, and a recent bruise on his jaw. Kress tried her best to look confident.
What do you need help with?
When I talked to you before, on the day of the ball, you told me that you've been spying on Earth's leaders and reporting back to Queen Levana. And you also knew that once Levana became Empress, she planned on having Kai assassinated so she could have total control of the Commonwealth and use that power to launch a full-scale attack on the other Earthen countries. Kress nodded, perhaps too vigorously.
Well, we need the people of Earth to know what lengths she's willing to go to in order to stake claim to Earth, not just the Commonwealth. If the other leaders knew that she'd been spying on them all this time, and that she has every intention of invading their countries the first chance she gets, there's no way they would condone this wedding. They wouldn't accept her as a world leader, the wedding would be canceled, and, with any luck, that'll give us a chance to, the ultimate goal is to dethrone her entirely.
Kress licked her lips.
So, what do you want me to do?
Evidence. I need evidence of what Levana's planning, of what she's been doing.
Pondering, Kress sank back in her chair. I have copies of all the video surveillance from over the years. It would be easy to pull up some of the most incriminating vids and send them to you over this link.
That's perfect.
It's circumstantial, though. It would only prove that Levana is interested in what the other leaders are doing, not necessarily that she plans on invading them. And I don't think I have any documentation about her wanting to murder His Majesty, either. It's largely my own suspicions and speculation on the things my mistress has said.
Well, that's fine. We'll take whatever you have. Levana already attacked us once. I don't think Earthens will take much convincing that she would do it again.
Kress nodded, but her enthusiasm had waned. She cleared her throat. My mistress will recognize the footage.
She'll know it was me who gave it to you. Cinder's smile began to fade, and Cress knew she didn't need to clarify her point. She would be killed for her betrayal.
I'm sorry, said Cinder. If there was any way for us to get you away from her, we would, but we can't risk coming to Luna, getting through port security.
I'm not in Luna!
The words tumbled out of Cress, coaxed on by a twist of hope.
You don't have to come to Luna. I'm not there.
Cinder scanned the room behind Cress. But you said before that you couldn't contact Earth, so you're not...
I'm on a satellite. I can give you my coordinates, and I checked weeks ago if your Rampian had compatible docking gear, and it does, or at least the pod ships that come standard with it do. You still have the pod ships, right?
You're on a satellite? Said Thorn.
Yes, set to a 16-hour polar orbit around Earth.
How long have you been living in a satellite?
She twisted her hair around her fingers. 7 years or so?
7 years? By yourself?
Yes, she shrugged. Mistress restocks my food and water, and I have net access, so it isn't so bad, but... Well...
But you're a prisoner, said Thorn.
I prefer damsel in distress, she murmured.
One side of Thorn's mouth quirked up, into that perfect half-smile he'd had in his graduation photo, a look that was a little bit devious and all sorts of charming. Cress's heart stopped, but if they noticed her melting into her chair, they didn't say anything. The red-haired girl leaned back, removing herself from the frame, though Cress could still hear her.
It's not like we can do anything that will make Levana want to find us even more than she already does.
Plus, said Cinder, exchanging looks with her companions, do we really want to leave someone in Levana's care who knows how to track our ship? Cress's fingers began to tingle where her hair was cutting off circulation, but she hardly noticed. Thorn tilted his head and peered at her through the screen.
All right, damsel. Send over those coordinates.
Chapter 6. Moving on to the dinner service. Her Lunar Majesty did approve the traditional 8-course feast following the ceremony since we last spoke. For that, I suggest we begin with a quartet of sashimi, followed by a light soup, perhaps imitation shark fin soup, which I think would strike a nice balance between old traditions and modern sensibilities. The wedding planner paused. When neither Kai, who was laid out on his office's sofa with one arm draped across his eyes, nor his chief advisor, Con Torin, offered any objections, she cleared her throat and continued.
For our third course, I thought a nice braised pork belly with green mango relish. That would then lead into our vegetarian entree, for which I recommend portol with poppy seeds on a bed of banana leaves. For the fifth course, I was going to talk to the caterers about some sort of shellfish curry, maybe with a vibrant coconut lime sauce. Does your majesty have any preference on lobster, prawns, or scallops?
Kai peeled his arm off his face, just enough to peer at the wedding coordinator through his fingers. Tashmi Priya must have been well into her 40s, and yet she had the sort of skin that hadn't aged a day past 29. Her hair, on the other hand, was making a slow transition into gray, and he thought it might have accelerated over the past week, as she was the one person in charge of communicating the bride's wishes to the rest of the wedding coordinators. He didn't for a moment underestimate the stress she was under to be working with Queen Levana. Luckily, it seemed to him that she was very, very good at her job. She'd accepted the role of planning the royal wedding without a moment's hesitation, and hadn't balked once at Levana's demands. Her professional perfectionism was evident in every decision she made, even in how she presented herself, with deceptively subtle makeup and not a hair astray. This simplicity was set against a wardrobe of traditional Indian saris, lush silk shot through with jewel tones and complicated embroidery. The combination gave Priya a regal air that Kai knew, at that moment, he was lacking. Scallops, lobster, he murmured, struggling to pay attention. Giving up, he covered his eyes again. No, I have no preference. Whatever Lavanna wants. A brief silence before he heard the click of fingernails against her port screen.
Perhaps we'll come back to the feast menu later. As for the ceremony, do you approve of the Queen's choice of Africa's Prime Minister Cayman as your officiant?
I can think of no one more suitable.
Excellent. And have you given any thought to your wedding vows?
Kai snorted. Delete anything that has to do with love, respect, or joy, and I'll sign on the dotted line.
Your Majesty, said Torin,
in that way he had of making the title of respect sound like a chastisement. Sighing, Kai sat up. Torin was in the seat opposite Priya, his hand wrapped around a short glass filled with nothing but ice cubes. He was not normally one to imbibe, which reminded Kai that these were trying times for everyone. He slid his attention back to Priya, whose expression was professionally impassive.
What do you suggest for the vows?
Her eyelids crinkled at the corners, almost apologetically, and he detected something horrible about to come his way.
Her Lunar Majesty has suggested that you write your own vows, Your Majesty.
Oh, stars. He fell back down into the cushions. Please, anything but that. A hesitation.
Would you like me to write them for you, Your Majesty?
Is that in your job description?
Ensuring that this wedding goes smoothly is my job description.
He peered up at the ornate tasseled chandeliers that lined the ceiling. After a complete sweep of the office that had taken his security team a week to complete, they had found a single recording device, smaller than his fingernail, embedded in one of those chandeliers. It was the only device they had found. There was no question that it was Lunar, and that Kai had been right all along. Lavanna was spying on him. His personal quarters had also been swept, though nothing had been discovered there. To date, these were the only rooms where he allowed himself to speak freely about his betrothed, though there was always a warning hum in his head. He really hoped the security detail hadn't missed anything.
Thank you, Taj Mijer.
I'll think on it. With a nod, Priya stood.
I have an appointment with the caterer this afternoon. I'll see if he has any input on the remaining courses.
Kai forced himself to stand, though the action was surprisingly difficult. The stress of the past weeks had caused him to lose a few pounds, and yet he felt heavier than ever, as if the weight of every person in the Commonwealth were pressing down on him.
Thank you for everything, he said, bowing while she gathered her color swatches and fabric samples.
She returned his bow.
We will speak again in the morning, before Thaumaturge Park's arrival.
He groaned.
Is that tomorrow already?
Torn cleared his throat. I mean, fantastic! He was such a joy to have around the first time. Priya's smile was fleeting as she slipped out of the door. Restraining a melodramatic sigh, Kai crumpled back onto the sofa. He knew he was being childish, but he felt he had the right to lash out occasionally, especially here in the privacy of his own office. Everywhere else, he was expected to smile and proclaim how much he was looking forward to the wedding, how beneficial this alliance would be for the Commonwealth, how he had no doubt that his marriage to Queen Lavanna would serve to unite the people of Earth and Luna in a way that hadn't been seen for centuries and would no doubt lead to greater appreciation and understanding of each other's cultures. It was the first step toward doing away with years of hatred and ignorance and... who on earth did he think he was fooling, anyway? He hated Lavanna. He hated himself for giving in to her. He hated that his father had managed to keep her and her threats of war at bay for years and years, and within weeks of Kai taking the throne, he'd let everything fall apart. He hated that Queen Lavanna had probably been planning this from the moment it was announced that Emperor Ryken, Kai's father, was ill, and that Kai had played right into her hands. He hated that she was going to win. The ice in Torrin's glass clacked and popped as he leaned forward.
You look pale, Your Majesty. Is there anything I can assist you with? Anything you would like to discuss?
Kai pushed his bangs off his forehead.
Be honest, Torrin. Do you think I'm making a mistake?
Torrin considered the question for a long moment, before setting the glass aside.
16,000 Earthens were killed when Luna attacked us. 16,000 deaths in only a few hours. That was 11 days ago. I cannot fathom how many lives were spared because of the compromise you made with Queen Lavanna.
He steepled his fingers over his lap.
And we cannot forget how many lives will be saved once we have access to her letamosis antidote.
Kai bit the inside of his cheek. These were the same arguments he'd been repeating to himself. He was doing the right thing. He was saving lives. He was protecting his people.
I know the sacrifice you're making, Your Majesty.
Do you? His shoulders tensed.
Because I suspect she's going to try to kill me, once she has what she wants, once she's been coronated.
Torrin inhaled sharply, but Kai got the impression that this wasn't news to Torrin after all.
We won't let that happen.
Can we stop it?
Your wedding will not be a death sentence. We have time to figure out a way. She still wants an heir, after all.
Kai couldn't stifle a grimace. Very, very small consolation.
I know, but that makes you valuable to her, at least for the time being.
Does it? You know the reputation Lunars have. I'm not sure Lavanna cares one bit who fathers a child, as long as someone does. And wasn't Princess Selene born without anyone knowing who her father was? I'm really not convinced Lavanna needs me for anything other than saying I do and handing her a crown. Much as he hated to admit it, the thought was almost a relief. Torrin didn't try to argue against him. He just shook his head.
But the Commonwealth does need you, and they will need you that much more once Lavanna becomes Empress. Your Majesty, I won't let anything happen to you.
Kai recognized an almost fatherly tone. There was affection there, where normally there was only patience and veiled frustration. In some ways, he felt like Torrin had become the true emperor once his father had passed away. Torrin was the solid one, the decisive one, the one who always knew what was best for the country. But looking at his advisor now, that impression began to shift. Because Torrin had a look that Kai had never seen directed toward himself before. Respect, maybe. Or admiration. Or even trust. He sat up a little straighter.
You're right. The decision has been made, and now I have to make the best of it. Waiting to be trampled under Lavanna's whims won't help anything. I have to figure out how to defend myself against her.
Torrin nodded, just shy of a smile.
We will think of something.
For a moment, Kai felt peculiarly bolstered. Torrin was not an optimist by nature. If he believed that there was a way, then Kai would believe it too. A way to stay alive, a way to protect his country even after he'd cursed them all with a tyrant for an empress. A way to protect himself from a woman who could control his thoughts with a bat of her lashes. Even as her husband, he would continue to defy Lavanna for as long as he could.
Nancy, Kai's android assistant, appeared in the office doorway, holding a tray with jasmine tea and hot washcloths. Her sensor light flashed.
Daily reports, Your Majesty?
Yes, thank you. Come in.
He took one of the washcloths off the tray as she rolled by, chafing his fingers with the steaming cotton. Nancy set the tray on Kai's desk and turned to face him and Torrin,
launching into the day's reports that blissfully had nothing to do with wedding vows or eight-course dinners.
Lunar Thaumaturge Amory Park is scheduled to arrive tomorrow at 1500, along with 14 members of the Lunar Court. A list of guest names and titles has been transferred to your port screen. A welcome dinner will commence at 1900, to be followed by evening cocktails. Tajmi Priya will be in attendance at both the dinner and cocktail reception. To begin communicating wedding plans to Thaumaturge Park, we've extended an invitation for Her Lunar Majesty to join us via NetScreen conferencing, but our offer was not accepted.
How disappointing, Kai drawled.
We are expecting a resurgence of protesters outside the palace with the arrival of the Lunar Court, which will likely continue through the date of the wedding ceremony. We have arranged for military reinforcements beginning tomorrow morning to ensure the security of our guests. I will alert you should any protests become violent.
Kai stopped cleaning his hands. Are we expecting them to be violent?
Negative, Your Majesty. The head of palace security has stated this is only a precaution.
Fine. Go on.
The weekly Letimosis report estimates 30,000 plague-related deaths during the week of 3 September throughout the Commonwealth. The palace research team did not have any progress to report on their ongoing search for an antidote.
Kai traded withering looks with Torin. 30,000 deaths. It almost made him wish the wedding were tomorrow, so he could get his hands on Lavanna's antidote that much sooner. Almost.
We have received word that the American Republic, Australia, and the European Federation have all instituted manhunts for the lunar soldiers responsible for the attacks, and claim to be holding multiple suspects as prisoners of war. So far, Luna has not threatened retaliation or made any attempt to bargain for their freedom, other than the previously made agreement that all soldiers will be removed from earthen soil following the coronation ceremony on the 25th.
Let's hope it stays that way, Kai muttered. The last thing this alliance needs are more political complications.
I will keep you posted on any developments, Your Majesty. The last item to report is that we've received word from Sam Hain Bristol, Parliament Representative from Toronto East Canada Province, United Kingdom, that he has declined his invitation to attend the wedding ceremony, on behalf of his refusal to accept Lunar Queen Lavanna as a suitable world leader within the Earthen Union.
Torin groaned as Kai rolled his eyes toward the ceiling. Oh, for all the stars, does he think anyone feels like she would be a suitable leader?
We can't blame him for this position, Your Majesty, said Torin, though Kai could hear the irritation in his tone. Or for wanting to make this statement. He has his own people to be concerned with.
I'm aware of that, but if this starts a trend among the Union leaders, Lavanna will be livid. Can you imagine her response if no one shows up for the wedding? Kai dragged the now cool washcloth down his face. She'll see this as a personal offense. If we're trying to avoid another attack, I don't think angering her is the way to do it.
I agree, said Torin, standing and adjusting his suit jacket. I will schedule a comm with Bristol Darren and see if we can't come to a compromise. I suggest we keep this information close for the time being, as to avoid giving our other invited guests any wayward ideas.
Thank you, Torin. Kai stood and matched Torin's bow before his advisor slipped out of the office. Kai barely resisted the urge to collapse back on the sofa. He had another meeting in 30 minutes, and there were still plans to review and reports to read and comms to respond to and—
Your Majesty?
He started. Yes, Nancy?
There was one additional report that I thought might be best to discuss with you in private.
He blinked. There were very few subjects that he didn't discuss with Torin.
What is it?
An association was recently discovered by my intelligence synapses. It involves Lynn Cinder.
His stomach dropped. It would be that topic. That one topic that he couldn't talk to even his most trusted advisor about.
Every time he heard her name, he was filled with barely constrained panic, certain that Cinder had been found. She had been taken into custody. She had already been killed. Even though he should have been glad that his country's most wanted fugitive had been captured, the thought made him ill. "What about her?" he said, tossing the washcloth back onto the tray and perching on the arm of the sofa.
"I may have deduced the reason that she was in Rhea, France."
The tirade of worried thoughts evaporated as quickly as they had come. Sensing a headache, Kai massaged the spot above his nose, relieved that one more hour had come and gone and Cinder was still missing, which meant she was still safe. "Rhea, France," he said, reorienting himself. Everyone had known that the ship Cinder was on would need to return to Earth eventually, for fuel and possible maintenance. Her choice of a small town, any small town, had never struck him as suspicious. "Go on."
"When Lynn Cinder removed the DCOM chip that had temporarily shut down my programming, I transmitted information to her about Michel Benoit."
"The pilot?" Kai had practically memorized the information Nancy had gathered regarding everyone who had even the most tenuous connection to the missing Princess Celine. Michel Benoit had been one of their top suspects for someone who had possibly helped to hide the princess.
"Yes, Your Majesty. Lynn Cinder would have known her name and her previous affiliation with the European military."
"So?"
"After retiring, Michel Benoit purchased a farm. That farm is located near Rhea, France, and it was on that property where the stolen ship first landed."
"So Cinder went there because... do you think she was looking for Princess Celine?"
"That is my assumption, Your Majesty."
He jumped to his feet and began pacing. "Has anyone spoken to Michel Benoit? Has she been questioned? Did she see Cinder talk to her?"
"I am sorry, Your Majesty, but Michel Benoit disappeared over 4 weeks ago."
He stalled. "Disappeared?"
"Her granddaughter, Scarlett Benoit, has gone missing as well. We know only that she boarded a maglev train in Toulouse, France, en route for Paris."
"Can't we track them?"
"Michel Benoit's ID chip was found in her home the day she went missing. Scarlett Benoit's ID chip, it appears, has been destroyed."
Kai slumped. Another dead end.
"But why would Cinder go there? Why would she care about finding Princess..."
He hesitated.
"Unless she's trying to help me."
"I cannot follow your reasoning, Your Majesty."
He faced Nancy again.
"Maybe she's trying to help me. Cinder knows that if she finds the princess, it could be the end of Lavanna's rule. I wouldn't have to marry her. She would probably be executed for treason. Cinder risked her life going to that farm, and she did it. She may have done it for me."
He could hear Nancy's fan whirring before she said,
"I might suggest the alternate explanation. That Lynn Cinder's motives stem from Queen Lavanna's desire to have her found and executed, Your Majesty."
Face flushing, he dropped his gaze to the hand-woven rug beneath his feet.
"Right. Or that."
But he couldn't shake the feeling that Cinder's new objective was about more than self-preservation. After all, she'd come to the ball to warn him against marrying Queen Lavanna, and that decision had nearly gotten her killed.
"Do you think she found anything about the princess?"
"I have no way of discerning that information."
He paced around his desk, staring thoughtfully at the vast city beyond his office window, glass and steel glinting in the afternoon sunlight.
"Find out everything you can about this Michel Benoit. Maybe Cinder is onto something. Maybe Princess Celine is still out there."
Hope fluttered again, brightening with every moment. His search for the princess had been abandoned weeks ago, when his life had become too tumultuous to focus on anything other than keeping war at bay, pacifying Queen Lavanna in her temper, preparing himself for a life at her side, as her husband.
And that only if he was lucky enough not to be murdered before their first anniversary.
He'd been so distracted that he'd forgotten the reason he'd been searching for Princess Celine in the first place. If she was alive, she would be the rightful heir to the Lunar Throne. She could end Lavanna's reign. She could save them all.
Chapter 7. Dr. Dimitri Erland perched on the edge of his hotel bed, with the worn cotton quilt pooling around his ankles. All his attention was on the battered net screen on the wall, the one where the sound cut out randomly and the picture liked to tremble and flicker at inopportune moments. Unlike the last time a lunar representative had come to Earth, this time the arrival was being internationally broadcast. This time, there was no hiding the purpose of the visit. Her Majesty, the Queen, had gotten what she wanted. She was going to become Empress. Though Queen Lavanna herself would not be arriving until closer to the ceremony date, Thaumaturge Amory Park, as one of her closest lackeys, advisors, was coming early as a show of goodwill to the people of the Commonwealth and planet Earth. That, and to ensure all wedding arrangements were being made to suit Her Majesty's preferences, no doubt. The shimmering white spaceship with its decorative runes had landed on the launch pad of New Beijing Palace 15 minutes ago, and still showed no sign of opening. A journalist from the African Union was droning on and on in the background about trivial wedding and coronation details. How many diamonds were in the Empress's crown, the length of the aisle, the number of expected guests, and, of course, yet another mention that Prime Minister Kamen herself had been selected as the ceremony's officiant. He was glad for one thing to result from this engagement, at least. All this ballyhoo had taken the media's attention off Miss Cinder. He'd hoped that she would have had the sense to take this serendipitous distraction and come find him, quickly. But that had not yet happened. He was growing impatient, and more than a little worried for the girl, but there was nothing he could do but wait patiently in this forsaken desert and continue with his research and plan for the day when all his hard work would finally come to fruition. Growing bored of the broadcast, Dr. Erland removed his spectacles and spent a moment huffing on them and rubbing them down with his shirt. It seemed that Earthens were quick to forget their prejudices when a royal wedding was involved. Or perhaps they were simply terrified to speak openly about the Lunars and their tyranny. Especially with the memory of the wolf hybrid attack so fresh in the collective memory. Plus, since the announcement of the royal engagement, at least two members of the worldwide media who had declared the alliance a royal mistake, a Net Group administrator from Bucharest on the Sea and a newsfeed editor from Buenos Aires, had committed suicide. Which, Dr. Erland suspected, was a diplomatic way of saying, murdered by Lunars, but who can prove it? Everyone was thinking the same thing, regardless of whether or not they would say it. Queen Lavanna was a murderer, and a tyrant, and this wedding was going to ruin them. But all his anger was eschewed by the knowledge that he was a hypocrite. Lavanna was a murderer? Well, he had helped her become one. It had been years, a lifetime it seemed, since he was one of the leading scientists on Luna's genetic engineering research team. He had spearheaded some of their greatest breakthroughs, back when Channery was still queen, before Lavanna took over, before his crescent moon was murdered, before Princess Celine was stolen away to Earth. He was the first to successfully integrate the genetics from an Arctic wolf with those of a 10-year-old boy, giving him not only many of the physical abilities that they'd already perfected, but the brutal instincts of the beast as well. Some nights, he still dreamed of that boy's howls in the darkness. Erland shivered. Pulling the blanket over his legs, he turned back to the broadcast. Finally, the space door lifted. The world watched as the ramp hit the platform.
A gaggle of lunar nobility arose from the ship first, bedecked in vibrant silks and flowing chiffons and veiled headdresses. Always with the veiled headdresses. It had become quite the trend during Queen Chanary's rule, who, like her sister, refused to reveal her true face in public. Erlaund found himself leaning closer toward the screen, wondering if he could identify any of his long-ago peers beneath their cloaks. He had no luck. Too many years had passed, and there was a good chance that all those telling details he'd memorized were glamour-created anyway. He himself had always given off the illusion of being much taller when he was surrounded by the narcissistic lunar court. The guards were next, followed by 5 third-tier thaumaturges, donning their embroidered black coats. They were all handsome, without any glamours, as the queen preferred, though he suspected that few of them had been born with such natural good looks. Many of his co-workers on Lunar had made lucrative side businesses offering plastic surgery, melatonin adjustments, and body reconstruction to thaumaturge and royal guard hopefuls. In fact, he'd always been fond of the rumor that Sybil Mira's cheekbones were made out of recycled plumbing pipes. Thaumaturge Amory came last, looking as relaxed and smug as ever in the rich crimson jacket that so well complemented his dark skin. He approached the waiting Emperor Cato and his convoy of advisors and chairmen, and they shared a mutually respectful bow. Dr. Erlaund shook his head. Poor young Emperor Kai. He had certainly been thrown to the lions during his short reign, hadn't he? A timid knock rattled the door, making Dr. Erlaund jump. Look at him, wasting his time with lunar processions and royal alliances that, with any luck, would never be realized. If only Lynsinder would stop gallivanting about Earth and space and start following directions for once. He stood and shut off the net screen. All this worrying was going to give him an ulcer. In the hallway was a squirrely boy who couldn't have been more than 12 or 13, with dark hair cut short and uneven. His shorts hung past his knees and were frayed at the hems, and his sandaled feet were coated in the fine sand that covered everything in this town. He was holding himself too tall, like he was trying to give the impression that he wasn't at all nervous, not one little bit.
"I have a camel for sale. I heard you might be interested."
His voice trembled on the last word. Dr. Erlaund dropped his spectacles to the end of his nose. The boy was scrawny, sure, but he didn't appear malnourished. His dark skin looked healthy, his eyes bright and alert. Another year or so, and Dr. Erlaund suspected he'd be the taller of the two of them. "One hump or two?" he asked.
"Two,"
the boy took in a deep breath.
"And it never spits."
Erlaund tilted his head. He had to be careful about who he told this code language to. But news seemed to be spreading quickly, even into neighboring oasis towns. It was becoming common knowledge that the crazy old doctor was looking for lunars who would be willing to help him with some experimentation, and that he could pay them for their assistance. Of course, the spreading knowledge of his semi-celebrity status, complete with Commonwealth want ads, hadn't hurt either. He thought many people who came to knock on his door were merely curious about the lunar who had infiltrated the staff of a real earthen palace, and who had helped the true celebrity, Lynsinder, escape from prison. He would have preferred anonymity, but this did seem to be an effective method for gathering new test subjects, which he needed if he was ever going to copy the letimosis antidote the lunar scientists had discovered.
"Come in," he said, stepping back into the room, without waiting to see if the boy followed.
He opened the closet that he had transformed into his own mini laboratory. Vials, test tubes, petri dishes, syringes, scanners, an assortment of chemicals, all neatly labeled.
"I can't pay you in univs," he said, pulling on a pair of latex gloves.
Barter only. What do you need? Food? Water? Clothing? Or if you're willing to wait on payment for 6 consecutive samples, I can arrange one-way transportation into Europe. No documentation required.
He opened a drawer and removed a needle from the sterilizing fluid.
What about medication?
He glanced back. The boy had barely taken 2 steps into the room.
Shut the door before you let in all the flies, he said.
The boy did as he was told, but his focus was now caught on the needle.
Why do you want medicine? Are you sick?
For my brother.
Also Luna.
The boy's eyes widened. They always did when Dr. Erland threw out the words so casually. But he never understood why. He only asked for Lunars. Only Lunars ever knocked on his door.
Stop looking so skittish, Dr. Erland grumbled. You must know that I'm Luna too.
He did a quick glamour to prove himself, an easy manipulation so that the boy perceived him as a younger version of himself, but only for an instant. Though he'd been tampering with bioelectricity more freely since he'd arrived in Africa, he found that it drained him more and more. His mind simply wasn't as strong as it used to be, and it had been years since he'd had any consistent practice. Nevertheless, the glamour did its job. The boy's stance relaxed, now that he was somewhat sure that Dr. Erland wouldn't have him and his family sent to the moon for execution. He still didn't come any closer, though.
Yes, he said. My brother is Lunar too, but he's a shell.
This time, it was Erlan's eyes that widened.
A shell? Now that had true value. Though many Lunars came to Earth in order to protect their non-gifted children, tracking those children down had proven more difficult than Erland had expected. They blended in too well with Earthans, and they had no desire to give up their disguise. He wondered if half of them were even aware of their own ancestry. How old? He said, setting the syringe down on the counter. I would pay double for a sample from him.
At Erlan's sudden eagerness, the boy took a step back.
7, he said. But he's sick.
With what? I have painkillers, blood thinners, antibiotics.
He has the plague, sir. Do you have medicine for that?
Dr. Erland frowned.
Letemosis? No. No, that isn't possible. Tell me his symptoms. We'll figure out what he really has.
The boy looked annoyed at being told he was wrong, but not without a tinge of hope.
Yesterday afternoon he started getting a bad rash with bruises all over his arms, like he'd been in a brawl. Except he hadn't. When he woke up this morning he was hot to the touch, but he kept saying he was freezing, even in this heat. When our mother checked, the skin under his fingernails had gone bluish, just like the plague.
Erland held up a hand.
You say he got the spots yesterday, and his fingers were already turning blue this morning.
The boy nodded.
Also, right before I came here, all those spots were blistering up like blood blisters.
He cringed. Alarm stirred inside the doctor as his mind searched for an explanation. The first symptoms did sound like letemosis, but he'd never heard of it moving through its 4 stages so quickly. And the rash becoming blood blisters? He'd never seen that before. He didn't want to think of the possibility, and yet it was also something he'd been waiting for years to happen. Something he'd been expecting. Something he'd been dreading. If what this boy said was true, if his brother did have letemosis, then it could mean that the disease was mutating. And if even a Lunar was showing symptoms. Erland grabbed his hat off the desk and pulled it on over his balding head.
Take me to him.
Chapter 8. Cress hardly felt the hot water beating on her head. Outside her washroom, a second-era opera blared from every screen. With the woman's powerful voice in her ears, swooning over the incessant shower,
Cress was the star, the damsel, the center of that universe. She sang along at full volume, pausing only to prepare herself for the crescendo. She didn't have the full translation memorized, but the emotions behind the words were clear. Heartbreak. Tragedy. Love. Chills covered her skin, sharply contrasted against the steam. She pressed a hand to her chest, drowning. Pain. Loneliness. Love. It always came back to love. More than freedom. More than acceptance. Love. True love, like they sang about in the Second Era. The kind that filled up a person's soul. The kind that lent itself to dramatic gestures and sacrifices. The kind that was irresistible and all-encompassing. The woman's voice rose in intensity with the violins and cellos, a climax sung up into the shower's downpour. Cress held the note as long as she could, enjoying the way the song rolled over her, filling her with its power. She ran out of breath first, suddenly dizzy. Panting, she fell against the shower wall. The crescendo died down into a simple, longing finale, just as the water sputtered out. All of Cress's showers were timed to ensure her water reserves wouldn't run out before Mistress Sybil's next supply visit. Cress sank down and wrapped her arms around her knees, realizing there were tears on her cheeks. She covered her face and laughed. She was being ridiculously melodramatic. But it was well deserved. Because today was the day. She'd been following the Rampian's path closely since they'd agreed to rescue her nearly 14 hours before, and they had not deviated from their course. The Rampian would be crossing through her satellite's trajectory in approximately 1 earthen hour and 15 minutes. She would have freedom, and friendships, and purpose. And she would be with him. In the next room, the operatic solo began again. Quiet and slow and tinged with longing. Thank you, Cress whispered to the imaginary audience that was going mad with applause. She imagined lifting a bouquet of red roses and smelling them, even though she had no idea what roses smelled like. With that thought, the fantasy disintegrated. Sighing, she picked herself off the shower floor before the tips of her hair could get sucked down the drain. Her hair weighed heavy on her scalp. It was easy to ignore when she was caught up in such a powerful solo, but now the weight of it threatened to make her topple over, and a dull headache was already creeping up from the base of her skull. This was not the day for headaches. She held up the ends of her hair with one hand, taking some pressure off her head, and spent a few minutes wringing it out, handful by soaking handful. Emerging from the shower, she grabbed her towel, a ratty gray thing she'd had for years, worn to holes in the corners. "Volume down!" she yelled out to the main room. The opera faded into the background. A few last droplets from the showerhead dribbled onto the floor. Cress heard a chime. She pulled her hair through her fists again, gathering another handful of water and shaking it out of the shower before wrapping herself in the towel. The weight of her hair still tugged at her, but was feeling manageable again. In the main room, all but the single DCOM screen were showing the theater footage. The shot was a close-up of the woman's face, thick with makeup and penciled eyebrows, a lion's mane of fire-red hair topped with a gold crown. The DCOM screen held a new message. From user mechanic, ETA, 68 minutes. Cress was buoyed by giddiness. It was happening. They were really coming to rescue her. She dropped the towel to the floor and grabbed the wrinkled dress she'd been wearing before. The dress that was a little too small and a little too short because Sybil had brought it for Cress when she was only 13, but that was worn to the perfect softness. It was Cress's favorite dress. Not that it had a lot of competition. She pulled it over her head, then rushed back into the bathroom to begin the long process of combing out her wet tangles. She wanted to look presentable, after all. No, She wanted to look irresistible. But there was no use dwelling on that. She had no makeup, no jewelry, no perfume, no properly fitting clothes, and only the most basic essentials for daily hygiene. She was as pale as the moon, and her hair would dry frizzy, no matter how she coddled it. After a moment of staring at herself in the mirror, she decided to braid it, her best hope for keeping it tamed. She had just divided it into three sections at the nape of her neck when Little Cress's voice squeaked.
"Big sister?"
Cress froze. She met her own wide-eyed gaze in the mirror.
"Yes?" "Mistress's ship detected. Expected arrival in 22 seconds.
"No, no, no. Not today," she hissed. Releasing her wet strands of hair, she rushed out into the main room. For once, her few belongings weren't strewn across the floor and tabletops, because they were all packed neatly inside a pulled-out drawer that sat on top of her bed. Dresses, socks, and undergarments neatly folded alongside hair combs and barrettes and what food packs she still had from Sybil's last visit. She'd even nestled her favorite pillow and blankets on top. All evidence that she was running away.
"Oh, stars!"
She swept forward and grabbed the drawer with both hands, pulling it off the bed. She tore out the blanket and pillow and tossed them onto the mattress before dragging the heavy drawer over to the desk she'd taken it from.
00, 14. 00, 13. 00, 12, sang Little Cress as she wrestled the drawer back into place. It wouldn't shut.
Cress squatted beside it, eyeing the rails to either side of the drawer. It took 7 more seconds of harried finagling before she managed to slam the drawer shut. Sweat or water from her still wet hair dripped down the back of her neck. Tugging out a lock of hair that had gotten caught in the drawer, she hastily straightened the bed as well as she could.
"Mistress has arrived. She is requesting an extension of the docking clamp."
"I'm getting there," Cress responded, darting toward the boarding ramp screen and entering the code. She turned back to the room as the clamp extended outside her walls, as Sybil's ship attached, as oxygen filled the space. The opera singer was still there, and Mistress would be annoyed at Cress's waste of time, but at least it wasn't... She gasped, her eyes landing on the one screen that stood out from the rest, and the single bright green message on a field of black. From User Mechanic, ETA, 68 minutes. She heard Sybil's steps approaching as she launched herself across the room. She shut down the screen just as the satellite door whistled open. Hard in her throat, Cress spun around and smiled. Sybil met her gaze from the doorway. She was already glaring, but Cress thought her eyes narrowed even more in that moment between seeing Cress and noting her brilliant grin.
"Mistress, what a surprise! I just got out of the shower, was just listening to some opera."
She gulped, her mouth suddenly dry. Sybil's eyes darkened, and she cast them around the room, at the screen still quietly transmitting the opera singer engrossed in her song. Sybil sneered.
"Earthen music."
Cress chewed on her lower lip. She knew there were musicians and plays and all sorts of entertainments for the Lunar Court, but they were rarely recorded, and Cress didn't have access to them. Lunars generally disliked having their true appearances transmitted for all the galaxy to see. They much preferred live performances where they could alter the audience's perception of their skills.
"All screens mute," she murmured, trying to stop shaking.
In the wake of silence, Sybil stepped inside, allowing the door to shut behind her. Cress gestured to the familiar metal box Sybil carried.
"I don't believe I'm in need of any supplies, Mistress. Is it time for another blood sample already?"
she asked, knowing it wasn't. Sybil set the box on the bed, sparing a distasteful glance for the rumpled blankets.
"I have a new assignment for you, Crescent. I trust you noticed that one of our primary feeds from New Beijing Palace was disabled last week."
Cress willed herself to look natural, collected, and unworried.
"Yes, the recorder from the Emperor's office."
"Her Majesty found it to be one of the more lucrative feeds we've placed on Earth. She wants another programmed and installed immediately."
She opened the box, revealing a collection of chips and recording devices.
"As before,
the signal should be untraceable. We don't want it drawing any attention to itself.
Cress nodded, perhaps too enthusiastically.
Of course, mistress. It won't take long. I can have it finished tomorrow. I'm sure it will be disguised in a light fixture, like the last one?
No, we risked too much by brainwashing the maintenance attendant before. Make it so that it can be more easily hidden. Able to embed on a wall hanging, perhaps. One of the other thaumaturges will likely handle the installation themselves during our upcoming visit.
Cress's head was still bobbing.
Yes, yes, of course, no problem.
Sybil scowled. Perhaps Cress was being too agreeable. She stopped nodding, but it was difficult to focus as a clock ticked in her head. If Cinder and the others spotted the lunar podship attached to her satellite, they would think Cress had led them into a trap. But Mistress Sybil never stayed long. Surely she would be well gone before the hour was up. Surely.
Is there anything else, Mistress?
Have you anything to report on the other earthen feeds?
Cress strained to think about any news she may have heard in the past few days. Her skills in cyber espionage went beyond research and hacking into earthen feeds and databases, or programming spy equipment to be strategically installed in various homes and offices of high-ranking officials. It was also one of her responsibilities to monitor those feeds and report anything interesting back to Sybil and Her Majesty. It was the most voyeuristic part of her job, which she hated. But at least if Sybil was asking her about it now, it meant that she and the Queen hadn't had time lately to monitor the feeds themselves.
Everyone's focused on the wedding, Cress said. Lots of talk of travel arrangements and scheduling diplomatic meetings while so many representatives are together in New Beijing.
She hesitated before continuing.
A lot of Earthens are questioning Emperor Kato's decision to enter into the alliance, and whether or not it will really signal an end to the attacks. The European Federation recently placed a large order from a weapons manufacturer. It seems they're preparing for war.
I could find the specifics of that order if you want.
Don't waste your time. We know what they're capable of. Anything else?
Cress searched her memory. She considered telling Mr. Sybil that one UK representative, a Mr. Bristol something, was trying to make a political statement by rejecting his invitation to the royal wedding, but she determined that his decision might still change. Knowing Her Majesty, she would want to set the man up as an example, and Cress didn't want to think what she would do to him, or his family.
No, mistress, that's all.
And what about the cyborg? Any progress there?
She had told the lie so many times it was effortless on her tongue.
I'm sorry, mistress, I haven't found anything new.
Do you suppose, Crescent, that her ability to go without detection is due to a similar technique we use to disguise our ships?
Cress pulled her damp hair away from her neck.
Perhaps. I understand she's a talented mechanic. Her skills may include software jamming.
And if that's the case, would you be able to detect it?
Cress opened her mouth, but hesitated. She most likely could, but telling Sybil that would be a mistake. She would only wonder why Cress hadn't thought of doing it sooner.
I don't think so, mistress, but I'll try. I'll see what I can find.
See that you do. I'm sick of making excuses for you.
Cress tried to look regretful, but her fingers were tingling with relief. Sybil always said some variation of this line when she was preparing to leave.
Of course, mistress. Thank you for bringing me this new work, mistress.
A chime sang through the room. Cress recoiled, but instantly attempted to morph her expression into nonchalance. Just another chime, just another non-suspicious alert for one of Cress's non-suspicious hobbies. Sybil had no reason to question it. But Sybil's attention had swerved to the single black screen that had awoken with the alert. A new message had appeared.
Message received from mechanic. ETA, 41 minutes. Need final coordinates.
The satellite tilted beneath Cress. But no, it was her own balance leaving her.
What is this? Sybil said, nearing the screen.
It's a game. I've been playing it with the computer.
Her voice squeaked. Her face was warming, cooled only where her damp hair clung to her cheeks. There was a long silence. Cress tried to feign indifference.
Just a silly game. Imagining the computer is a real person. You know how my imagination can be when I get lonely. Sometimes it's nice to have someone to talk to, even if they're not...
Sybil grabbed Cress's jaw, shoving her hand against a window that overlooked the blue planet.
Is it her? Sybil hissed. Have you been lying to me?
Cress couldn't speak, her tongue heavy with terror, as if she were pinned by a glamour. But this was not magic. This was only a woman strong enough and angry enough to tear Cress's arms from their sockets, to break her skull against the corner of the desk.
You had better not even think to lie to me, Crescent. How long have you been communicating with her?
Her lips trembled.
Since yesterday, she half-sobbed. I was trying to earn her trust. I thought if I could get close enough, I could tell you and...
A slap sent the world spinning, and Cress hit the floor. Her cheek burned, and her brain took a moment to stop rattling inside her skull.
You hoped she was going to rescue you, said Sybil.
No, no, mistress.
After all I've done for you, saved your life when your parents meant to have you slaughtered.
I know, mistress. I was going to bring her to you, mistress. I was trying to help.
I even allowed you net access to watch those disgusting earthen feeds, and this is how you repay me?
Sybil eyed the screen where the message still lingered. But at least you've finally done something useful. Cress shuddered. Her brain began to cloud with the instinctual need to run, to escape. She shoved herself off the floor, but tripped on her hair and landed hard against the closed doors. Her fingers sought out the keypad, punching in the command. The doors zipped open. She did not wait to see Sybil's reaction.
Closed door!
Cress flew down the corridor, lungs burning. She couldn't breathe. She was hyperventilating. She had to get out. Another door loomed before her. An identical switch beside it. She barreled into it.
Open!
It did. She stumbled forward and her abdomen smacked into a railing. She grunted from the collision, bracing herself before she could topple over it and straighten into the cockpit. She stood, panting and staring wide-eyed at the interior of a small pod ship. Lights and flashing panels and screens glowed all around her. The windows formed a wall of glass separating her from a sea of stars. And there was a man. His hair was the color of golden straw, and his body strong and broad in his royal uniform. He looked like he could be threatening, but at that moment, he seemed only astonished. He raised himself from the pilot seat. They gawked at each other as Cress struggled to find words amid her tumbling thoughts. Sybil did not come alone. Sybil had a pilot that brought her here. Another human being knew that Cress existed. No, another Lunar knew that Cress existed.
Help me,
she tried to whisper, gulping when the words couldn't form.
Please, please help me.
He shut his mouth. Cress's hands twitched on the bar.
Please,
her voice broke. The man flexed his fingers and she thought, was it only her imagination? His eyes seemed to soften, to sympathize, or to calculate. His hand shifted toward the controls, the command to shut the door, to disengage from the satellite, to fly her away from the prison.
I don't suppose you killed her, he said.
The words seemed like they came from a different language altogether. He said them emotionlessly, a simple question, expecting a simple answer. Killed her? Killed her? Before she could form a response, the guard's eyes sped past her. Sybil grabbed a fistful of Cress's hair and yanked her back toward the corridor. Cress screamed and collapsed onto the ground.
Jason, we're about to have company, said Sybil, ignoring Cress's sobs. Separate yourself from the satellite, but stay close enough to have good visual without drawing suspicion. When an earthen ship draws close, they will likely release one pod ship. Wait until the pilot has boarded the satellite and then rejoin us using the opposite entry hatch. I will ensure the clamp is pre-extended.
Cress trembled, nonsense words falling from her in hopeless pleas. The man's sympathy and astonishment were gone, vanished as if they'd never been there. Perhaps they never had. He jerked his head in a nod, no question, no thought to disobey. Though Cress screamed and kicked, Sybil managed to drag her all the way back to the satellite's main room, tossing her like a bag of broken android parts on the floor. The door shut behind them, dividing her from the exit, from her freedom, and with its familiar clang, she knew. She would never be free. Sybil was going to kill her. And she was going to kill Lynn Cinder and Carswell Thorne. When Cress pushed back her mess of hair, a sob shook her to the bones. Sybil was smiling.
I suppose I should thank you. Lynn Cinder is going to come to me, and our queen will be so pleased.
Bending down, Sybil grasped Cress's chin in a claw-like grip.
Unfortunately, I don't think you'll survive long enough to receive your reward.
Chapter 9. Cinder groaned, the impact of her most recent landing still reverberating through her spine. The cargo bay's ceiling spun and wobbled in her vision.
Was that necessary?
Wolf and Scarlet appeared above her.
I'm sorry, said Wolf. I thought you had control. Are you all right? Frustrated and sore, but yes, I'm fine.
She forced herself to take Wolf's outstretched hand. He and Scarlet both helped her to her feet.
You're right, I lost focus. I felt your energy snap out of my hold like a rubber band.
That was moments before Wolf completed the maneuver she'd managed to halt for 6 whole seconds, grasping her arm and tossing her over his shoulder. She rubbed her hip.
I need a moment.
Maybe you should call it quits for the day, said Scarlet. We're almost to the satellite.
Iko chimed in.
Estimated time of arrival is 9 minutes, 34 seconds, which, by my estimation, is enough time for Cinder to be defeated and embarrassed in 7 more brawls.
Cinder glared up at the ceiling.
Also just enough time to disconnect your audio device.
Since we have a few minutes, said Scarlet, maybe we should talk about how to handle this girl. If she's been stuck on a satellite for 7 years with no one to talk to but a lunar thaumaturge, she might, be socially awkward. I think we should all make an effort to be extra welcoming and supportive and try not to terrify her.
A laugh came from the cockpit, and Thorne appeared in the doorway, strapping a gun holster around his waist. You're asking the cyborg fugitive and the wild animal to be the welcoming committee? That's adorable. Scarlet planted her hands on her hips.
I'm saying we should be aware of what she's been through, and try to be sensitive to that. This may not be an easy transition for her.
Thorne shrugged. The Rampian is going to be like a 5-star hotel after living on that satellite. She'll adjust.
I'll be nice to her, said Iko. I can take her net shopping, and she can help me pick out my future designer wardrobe. Look, I found this custom escort shop that has the best accessories and some discounted models. What would you think of me with orange hair?
The net screen on the wall switched to an escort droid sale listing. The image of a model was slowly rotating, showing off the android's perfect proportions, peachy skin, and royalty-approved posture. She had purple irises and cropped tangerine hair and a tattoo of an old-fashioned carousel that rotated around her ankle. Cinder squeezed an eye shut.
Iko, what does this have to do with the satellite girl?
I was getting to that.
The screen scrolled through a menu, landing on hair accessories and dozens of icons clustered together, showing everything from dreadlocked wigs to cat-ear headbands to rhinestone-encrusted barrettes.
Just think of how much potential she has with hair like that!
You see, said Thorne, nudging Scarlet in the shoulder. Iko and the imprisoned, socially awkward satellite girl, best friends forever. Now,
What I'm worried about is how we're going to be dividing the reward money when this is all over, because this ship is starting to feel awfully crowded, and I'm not sure I'm happy with all of you cutting into my profits.
What reward money? Asked Scarlet.
The reward Cinder's gonna pay us out of the lunar treasury once she's queen. Cinder rolled her eyes.
I should have guessed.
And that's just the beginning. By the end of this escapade, the whole world will see us as heroes. Imagine the fame and fortune, the sponsorship opportunities, the marketing requests, net dramatization rights. I think we should discuss the profit division sooner rather than later, because I'm considering a 60-10-10-10-10 split right now.
Am I the fourth 10%? Said Aiko. Or is that satellite girl? Because if it's that satellite girl, I'm going on strike.
Can we discuss this imaginary money later? Said Cinder.
Like, maybe when there's actual money to discuss? Suggested Scarlet. Besides, don't you still have to prepare the pod ship?
Oui, mademoiselle. With a salute, Thorn grabbed a handgun off a storage crate and sank it into the holster. Scarlet cocked her head.
Are you sure you don't want me to go? It's going to require some precise maneuvering to attach the docking clamp.
And from what Cinder told me about your flying skills...
What do you mean? What did Cinder say about my flying skills?
Scarlet and Cinder shared a look.
Naturally, she told me that you're a fantastic pilot, said Scarlet, grabbing her red hoodie off a crate.
Though it had been badly torn in Paris, she'd stitched it up as well as she could.
Absolutely top-notch.
I think she was practicing her sarcasm, said Aiko.
Thorn glared, but Cinder only shrugged.
I'm just saying, continued Scarlet, threading her arms through the sleeves, it may not be an easy attachment. You have to dock slowly, and don't leave the pod until you're sure the satellite system's compatible and you have a secure connection.
I can handle it, said Thorn. Winking, he reached out and gave Scarlet's nose a tweak, ignoring how Wolf bristled behind her. But you sure are sweet to be so concerned about me. The docking clamp engaged on Thorn's second attempt, which he thought was pretty good for never having docked with a satellite before. He hoped Scarlet was watching, after she'd so brazenly doubted his abilities. He checked the connection before putting the pod ship into standby mode and unlatching his harness. Through the window, he could see the curving side of the satellite and one of its circular gyrodynes whirling lazily overhead, propelling the satellite through space. He could see only the edge of the docking hatch through the ship's windows, but it appeared secure, and his instruments were telling him that the pressure and oxygen levels made it safe to exit his ship. He tugged his collar away from his throat. He was not, by nature, a paranoid man, but dealing with lunars gave him more hesitation than he was accustomed to. Even young, semi-cute ones. Young, semi-cute ones who had probably been driven insane by years of solitude. Thorn unlatched the podship door and it swung upward, revealing two steps up to a ramp edged with a rail, and beyond it a narrow corridor. His ears popped with the change in pressure. The entrance into the main satellite was still shut tight, but as he approached, he heard a hissing noise and the doors parted, sliding seamlessly into the walls. He recognized the room from the DCOM connection. Dozens of flat, clear screens, some overhead storage cabinets, a mussed-up bed with worn blankets, a wash of bluish-white light coming from built-in fixtures. A door to the left led to what he assumed was a washroom. And directly opposite him, there was the door to the second podship hatch. The girl was sitting on the edge of the bed, her hands in her lap, her hair pooling over both shoulders and ending in a bundle of knotted frizz by her shins. She was smiling, a close-lipped, polite look that was entirely at odds with the nerve-bundled reaction she had had over the DCOM. But that smile faltered when she saw him.
Oh, it's you. She said, tilting her head to the side. I was expecting the cyborg.
No need to look so disappointed, Thorn thrust his hands into his pockets. Cinder can fix ships, but she's useless at flying them. I'll be your escort today,
Captain Carswell Thorne, at your service. He tipped his head toward her. Rather than swoon or flutter her lashes, as was duly expected of her, the girl looked away and glowered at one of the screens. Coughing, Thorne rocked back on his heels. Somehow he'd expected that a girl with no prior human interaction would be a lot easier to impress.
You all packed up? We don't like to loiter in one spot for long.
Her eyes flickered to him, hinting at annoyance.
No matter, she murmured to herself. Jason and I will go to her then.
Thorne frowned, feeling a twist of regret at his previous mocking, even if it had only been in his own head. What if the solitude really had driven her crazy?
Jason?
She stood up, her hair swinging against her ankles. He hadn't been able to tell how tall she was before, but now, seeing that she couldn't have been much more than 5 feet, he felt comforted. Crazy or not, she was harmless. Probably.
Jason, my guard.
Right. Well, why don't you invite your friend Jason to join us, and let's get going.
Oh, I don't think you'll be getting far.
She stepped toward him, and at that moment, she changed. The nest of hair grew dark and silky as a raven's wing. Her eyes changed from sky blue to slate gray. Her pale skin turned golden, and her body stretched upward, becoming tall and graceful. Even her clothes changed, from the plain, worn day dress to a dove-white coat with long sleeves. Thorne was quick to bury his surprise. A thaumaturge, figured. Not one for denial, he accepted the immediate resignation with a stiffening of his shoulders. It had all been a trap then. The girl had been bait, or perhaps she'd been in on it all along. Funny, he usually had better instincts when it came to these sorts of things. He stole another glance around the room, but there was no sign of the girl. Something clanged outside the second entry hatch, shaking the satellite. Hope. His crew must have noticed something was wrong. That would be them now, aboard the second pod ship. He called up his most practiced, most charming grin, and reached for his gun. He even felt a sting of pride when he managed to get it all the way out of its holster before his arm froze of its own accord. Thorne shrugged with the one uncontrolled shoulder.
You can't blame me for trying.
The thaumaturge smirked, and Thorne's fingers loosened. The gun clattered to the ground. Captain Carswell Thorne, is it?
That's right.
I'm afraid you won't have claim to the title for long. I'm about to commandeer your Rampion for the Queen.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Additionally, I assume you are aware that assisting a wanted fugitive, such as Lynn Cinder, is a crime punishable by death on Luna. Your sentence is to be carried out immediately.
Efficiency. I respect that.
The second entry door opened behind her. Thorne tried to send mental warnings to his companions. It was a trap. Be ready. But it was not Cinder or Scarlet or Wolf who stood in the secondary entry hatch, but a lunar guard. Thorne's hope began to wither.
Jason, we will be boarding the Rampion using its own pod ship.
Ah, you're Jason, said Thorne. I thought she was making you up. They ignored him, but he was rather used to that.
Go see that it's ready to disembark as soon as I'm finished here.
The guard respectfully inclined his head and moved to follow her commands.
Careful, said Thorne. It wasn't an easy connection. Required some real precise maneuvering. In fact, would you like me to come disconnect the ship for you, just to make sure you do it right?
The guard eyed him smugly as he passed, not as empty-eyed as he'd appeared before. But he didn't respond as he slipped into the corridor, heading toward Thorne's pod ship. The thaumaturge grabbed a blanket from the bed and tossed it at Thorne. He would have caught it on reflex, but it wasn't necessary. His hands did all the work without him. Soon, he found himself wrapping the blanket around his own wrists and tying it into intricate knots, giving the blanket a final yank with his teeth to tighten it into place.
I look forward to returning to Luna aboard your ship and spreading the good news that Lynn Cinder is no longer a threat to our crown.
His eyebrow twitched.
Anything I can do to assist Her Majesty's benevolent cause.